Good morning, members. We have a fairly full committee here, and we certainly have the core team of the DDG here, DDG Zodwa and Thuli here, who are also just going to share with us the information we had requested earlier that was outstanding, and they prepared just for that. So although it talks about deliberations, all of you will recall that there are responses that remain outstanding. Am I correct in that? Having said that, some of you may also see new faces here. I'm not sure if they're all here now. Perhaps they're not all here. No, the only new face I do see here is Sue van der Merwe. But the committee meeting does start at 9 and not at 9:30 for any new members who may be joining us. I know there were queries on this from one of the new members who was not fully aware of the actual schedule, and it was not some of the those that some are pointing to, and some I've just seen walking in. So the one new member is Honourable Sue van der Merwe, and the other one is Honourable Joe Salah that I'm aware of. We have an apology from, Honourable Lavenia, but the alternate in the IFT is here, and that is the Honourable Oriani Ambrosini. We have two other apologies received now from the Honourable Impash Lely and the Honourable Albert. I'm not aware of the reason at this point. So what we're going to do before we even go along deliberations, we're going to be handing over the two DTI. But before that, we should indicate again that Honourable Kwabasa, who is here at the moment, is going to attend TRALAC, this trade workshop, on behalf of the committee, because I cannot be there, and neither I asked the whip not to attend either, so that we could be here this morning. The content advisor, Ms. Hurling, has also addressed what we asked her to address any gaps that she may have identified, which she shared with Manco, and those which were raised in the submissions, which referred directly to the Act, but bearing in mind we have a bill before us, and so we're not simply dealing with the Act, but with the amendment bill in relation to the Act. Nevertheless, she did raise this, and she has this morning distributed, or late last night, three copies of this, because it would have gone through your mailboxes. The DTI are only now in receipt of that. I have discussed this matter with the DDG. So because of that, we have asked Ms. Hurling immediately after we have received the responses, which were outstanding, to address the three pages, which are called Gaps Between Issues Raised and the DTI's Responses, and then additional issues not covered in the amendment bill. Right. So let us, we've also been asked by many of the leadership in Parliament to try and expedite the meeting through ensuring that members come properly prepared and that they're not making speeches. So there's now no question of people being given 2 minutes, etc. It's going to be, if you can fit three questions into 1 minute, then it's three questions. But it's 1 minute, please. That's to all members. Thank you very much. And you may have a second round if there is time. So, We do have an apology to leave earlier, a request from the Honourable September, who is attending also as a full member in another committee as well, and they require a quorum to proceed with their work. And we also have a medical apology from the Honourable Sue van der Merwe, one of our new members who's with us. The two members are very welcome. Thank you. So it's over to the department. You'll just do a quick introduction if necessary.
Thank you, sir. Thank you, honourable members, and good morning, everybody. And we're happy to see the other new members. I'm going to just ask the team to quickly introduce themselves, and then from there we can start with the business of the day for today. Thanks.
Morning, Chair, and honourable members. My name is McDonald Nestenge, Acting Chief Director, Police and Legislation. Thanks.
Good morning, Madam Chair. My name is Johan Strader. I'm an internal legal advisor with the Department of Trade and Industry.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members. My name is Rory Waller. I'm Head of Legal Services at Cipro.
Good morning, Chair, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Flip Twiner. I'm from Cipro Legal Division.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Bongi Mnube. I'm from the DTI.
Morning, everyone. My name is Mokhtubu Chipiwa, DTI.
Morning. I'm Desmond Ramabran from the DTI.
Thank you very much. My name is Dodwa Nduli. I'm the Deputy Director General in the Department of Trade and Industry, and I'm responsible for consumer and corporate regulation. Chair, we will be guided by yourself, obviously, in terms of how we proceed with this. When we presented the last time our responses, we did provide a detailed grid in terms of the comments that were made by the stakeholders and how we respond to those comments. And as we were going through the responses in the last meeting, we were asked specific questions about certain areas in terms of how we propose the drafting, if it's revised, to look like. And that is the task that we went back to try and do in terms of looking at all of those to say what can be proposals that this committee can consider if it feels that it accepts some of the recommendations that were made during the public hearings and also in terms of the responses that were made. So at this point, what we're going to do, we have not prepared any PowerPoint presentation, but we have prepared a document that we can go through with yourself. And like we're saying again, we are guided by this committee. All we have here is the proposals that we are putting on the table for consideration, and that the committee obviously will take it from here. I'll head over to McDonald and Johan. I think those are the people that will lead us in this process. And I think where necessary, I think the state law advisor will give some input into some of the areas. Thank you very much, Johan.
With your permission, Madam Chair, before we proceed on the basis of this document, if I may just very briefly, without repeating what the DDG has said, but just for the sake of our perspective as we move along this document. Needless to say, the document with the heading Companies Amendment Bill 40 of 2010 and then proposals for consideration by the Portfolio Committee on Trade and Industry, and it's got a little explanatory note there. That will be the primary document serving before this Honourable Committee this morning. But having said that, we can't properly read or appreciate this document without also having reference to the bill that was introduced, which is the bill that has been serving before the committee for quite some time now. This document speaks directly to the introduced bill. That's why we find in the explanatory note there the little comment saying that all references to clauses or sections in this document relate directly to clauses or sections in the introduced bill. Now, unfortunately, and we've got no option, we cannot simplify this any further. In certain instances, in order to appreciate the whole extent of an amendment, we will also have to refer to the Principal Act, which is, can I rather refer to the new Companies Act. So, unfortunately, in a few instances, we will have to refer to both the new Act, then the introduced bill, amending the new Act, and then, of course, this document. Madam Chair, once again, we are very sensitive as to being presumptuous or possibly being audacious in prescribing or proposing any amendments to this Honourable Committee. We are fully aware of the fact that the bill is not in our hands. The bill has been introduced into Parliament. It is actually the bill of this committee. And that any amendments that should eventually be effected to the introduced bill should be agreed upon, definitely not by us, but by the members of this Honourable Committee. We are presenting them this morning this document on the basis of that very assumption. Before I start dealing with the document and maybe just require your guidance as well, Madam Chair, allow me just to make one other observation. I will not be speaking from my own mouth, so to speak. I'm sitting here and speaking collectively. We have all been involved in the preparation of this document. Mr. Hugh Hercules from the State Law Advisors, also in attendance, he was also part and parcel of us compiling this document. So I will literally be speaking collectively and I will not be moving alone. It will be necessary here and there that I be assisted by some of the other members of the team. If we refer to page 2, if I can maybe for the sake of abbreviation, if I refer to the document, then it is the document containing the proposals. If I refer to the bill, it will be the introduced bill that has been serving before the committee. And if I refer to the new Act, it will be the new Principal Act. That is the document indeed. Madam Chair, it is a rather lengthy document. It stems directly from the document dated the 28th of January, which we might not need this morning, but that was the document that formed the basis of our last discussions with this Honourable Committee. The essence of that document was to reflect in the form of a diagram the essence of the evidence or the presentations that were made during the public hearings, to reflect each of them in columns, and then to make certain comments in respect of those submissions. And needless to say, in arriving at this document that we will be discussing this morning, we not only reflected on the evidence that was given during the public hearings, but also specifically took account of the discussions and the deliberations that took place in this committee by members in respect of that evidence. So I hope I can safely say that in a sense, this is a collective committee, not document not only coming from the DTI, but almost coming from the members of your committee. Madam Chair. I will now move on in the interest of time to the document, but I need your guidance, Madam Chair, just on a single aspect. It might become cumbersome and a bit tedious for the members if we just carry on speaking monotonously on each and every clause now that we have in this document. What I'm asking your guidance on is, would you prefer, or members would prefer maybe, that we deal with a single clause and any proposals in respect of a single clause, and we then pause for questions, or would you prefer that we carry on and deal with them all clause by clause and deal with issues arising from the floor at a later stage, Madam Chair? If I can just get your guidance, or we can get your guidance in that respect.
Well, I also only got the document now myself, we realised that there was an attempt by yourself certainly to make sure we got it last night or yesterday, but it somehow didn't work out through what we were trying to discuss this earlier on with the department. So the reality is, I don't know how many clauses you actually have here. Quite clearly, you don't have 118, you know. But, you know, if you look just at what you have here, which is quite a thick document, it may be advisable, unless I see an urgent hand going up, for us to proceed, you know, try and get through, as it were, some of at least 5 or 10 at a time before we pause, unless you feel that there's a complication that you yourself would like us to pause on. Because I'm looking at this for the first time, you see. And I think, members, we're going to have to play it like that to save time. We can't have a pause after each clause you follow. But all of us are getting this for the first time, not only once. I would appeal to members to make notes on the copies, so that after that time we can just go back. So I hope that can help you as well as ourselves in managing the time.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I will then proceed and deal straight away with Clause 1 of the document. It relates to, needless to say, to Clause 1 of the poll, dealing with nothing but definitions. Under Clause 1, let me just refer to this also straight away, we will see now a D and a J and a T and a U clearly, they're not alphabetically. The reason simply being that they relate directly to the numbering in the bill. So if we reflect on D, we can simply go to paragraph D under clause 1 in the bill, and we will see the definition there. If I can deal simultaneously with the definition of asset under D, the definition of creditor under J, and the definition of liability under T, The sentiment that was simply expressed in this respect is, why do we define concepts that are almost part of the vocabulary of the layperson, or possibly have specific connotation or meaning as it relates to other acts? For instance, the National Credit Act, where surely it will tell you what is a creditor, or where we possibly have jurisprudence or judicial decision-making in respect of certain definite concepts. We, with respect, agree with the submissions that were made. And what is done in Clause 1, D, J, and T, should the Honourable Committee approve of these amendments, they would delete the definitions of asset, of creditor, and liability from the bill.
Can you just intervene for one moment? What you're proposing is that, as I said, we said we would be doing, we would have to consider amendments ourselves, and we asked you to come back then with some proposals which would assist us in, you know, moving forward towards possible amendments in this regard. So essentially, from here, these are proposals which you are looking at, which we can look at ourselves if necessary. Thank you.
Absolutely, Madam Chair. And needless to say that the amendments can only be effected by this committee on the basis of the so-called A Bill. This is not an A Bill. The A Bill will be compiled later by the committee. That will be the bill reflecting the actual amendments agreed to by this committee. We're now simply dealing with the proposals. Madam Chair, the next one is slightly more complicated, but not really. That is on the definition of master. Submissions were made that our definition of master under clause 1 of the bill is in some way inconsistent, but no specific reference was made as far as where that inconsistency might arise. Now, if we read the definition as we have it in the bill, we will see that master means the officer of the High Court, referred to in Section 2 of the Administration of the States Act. We have specifically decided rather to latch on to that definition because there is an extensive definition of master in the Administration of the States Act, where, of course, the master performs most of his or her functions as they relate to deceased estates. Needless to say, make a copy available to members. Maybe we should have, Madam Chair, but just allow me very, very briefly to read what we find in the Administration of the States Act. It says, master, in relation to any matter, property, or estate, means the master, deputy master, or assistant master of a high court, appointed under Section 2, who has jurisdiction in respect of a matter, property, or estate, and who is subject to the control, direction, and supervision of the Chief Master. Unless we can find a specific reference as to where the inconsistency arises, Madam Chair, we respectfully propose that the committee would consider to leave the definition of master intact as we find it in the bill. Madam Chair, the next one, still under clause 1, the numbering is that small v in brackets. May I simply almost skip over it by merely saying that it is nothing more than the correction of an incorrect reference. Item 4 of Schedule 2 is incorrect. It should be Schedule 1. It is merely a matter of referencing. There is no policy consideration whatsoever. The next one, Madam Chair, is the double D's, the small double D's in brackets, as they relate to the definition of securities. And we will see there two words being omitted right at the bottom of page 2 of our document. Securities means any shares, notes, comma, bonds. The comment was made that notes and bonds are in essence not securities. They are derived from other financial instruments and should therefore not be defined as securities, but they should be defined as derivative instruments. On the basis of that, the proposal that the two words notes and bonds be omitted from the definition of securities. And also right at the end, the few words for the purpose, that is on the top of page 3, for the purpose of raising capital. There is no reason why that should be a requirement. I move on to the next one on page 3, Madam Chair, which is clause 2. It deals with the amendment of section 4 of the Act, as we find it in clause 2 of the bill. It looks very ugly on the eye, and we apologize for that. we can see that clause 2, everything that we've got there is being struck through. So the proposal is that consideration should be given to the deletion of this whole provision. What does it relate to? It relates to the solvency and liquidity test as it applies to companies. I hope I'll be fair in saying the following, that if this provision is not omitted from the bill, the solvency and liquidity test would be applied to a group of companies. I'm sorry, Madam Chair, am I too close to the microphone?
No, it's as if you trained for the mic.
Sorry. if this provision is not omitted, that test, if we can take, for example, there's a group of companies, as we know so well, there might be 10 companies in a group of companies, a mother company, and then you've got the affiliates or the subsidiary companies. But all 10 of those companies relate to a group of companies. If this provision remains, the solvency and liquidity test would apply to the 10 companies within that group. Now, surely that might be grossly unfair in certain instances. It might well be that 5 of the 10 companies are doing perfectly well financially, paying their debts and the rest. But now the test is being applied to the whole group. 5 companies fail the test, now the whole group of companies fail the test. So we respectfully submit that serious consideration should be given to deleting this whole provision from the bill. There is no rationale for penalizing 5 economically viable companies for what has been done by 5 other companies in the group. The legal principle is clear. Each and every company in that group is a juristic person or a legal entity in its own right and performs its business on that basis. The stigma of the other 5 should not be attached to the 5 viable companies. I hope that that takes care of clause 2, Madam Chair. If I may then move on to clause number 3, we will recall during the public hearings and also during the deliberations that a lot has been said as far as the proposal under clause number 3 is concerned. The argument being that all financial or tax laws or legislation should take precedence to whatever is provided for in the new Companies Act. If there is any provision pertaining to financials or to tax, then the new Companies Act must be subject or subordinate to any such financial or tax legislation. The argument has also been that why should the new Companies Act be subordinate to all financial or tax legislation? Surely it would be better to focus on each and every specific piece of legislation and see where there should be precedence or where this act should be overridden by what is provided for in the other legislation. What is the basis of this amendment? And unfortunately, here now we have an instance for proper reading that we must refer to the Principal Act as well. It is Section 5 of the Principal Act, and it is Subsection 4. I will very briefly read it, Madam Chair. You can all read better than I do. If there is an inconsistency between any provision of this Act and a provision of any other national legislation, then, in B, to the extent that it is impossible to apply or comply with one of the inconsistent provisions without contravening the second, then any applicable provisions of the acts listed here will take precedence over the Companies Act, the Auditing Profession Act, the Labour Relations Act, and so we carry on.
Page 36 of the Principal Acts, is it? 38.
Madam Chair, my text differs from your...
Your text differs, all right.
Page numbers.
All right.
It is Section 5, Subsection 4B in the new Act, the Principal Act. What this amendment proposes, Madam Chair, is that consideration should be given not for the Companies Act to be overridden by all financial or tax laws, but that these two should be added to that list. It is the local government, this is now on page 3 of our document under clause 3. It is the local government, Municipal Finance Management Act, and Section 8 of the National Payment System Act. So where we find inconsistencies between provisions in those acts, they will take precedence over what we find in the new Companies Act. Madam Chair, I move on to the bottom of page 3 of our document, which is under clause 6. And if you would allow me to deal with clause 6 and clause 9 in one breath, because the principle is exactly the same. This was merely an oversight for omitting the word PTY in brackets from PTY Limited. We find the very same thing in clause 9. I might not need to say anything more, Madam Chair. Clearly, those abbreviations or acronyms as they relate to companies are necessary and they should be retained. That is what is being provided for should the proposals in clause 6 and clause 9 be adopted by this Honourable Committee. Madam Chair, the next one is on page 4 of our document. It relates to section 30 in the Act. If you would also permit me to deal with it very, very briefly, Madam Chair, it cuts no ice whatsoever. There is the proposed change. It is clause 8 of our document, page 4. It is section 30, and then it relates to subsection 11B, starting with prejudice or affect the identity of the body corporate. The word body corporate slipped in there. Body corporate has got totally a different connotation. Maybe as it relates to a block of flats or whatever. Surely it must be juristic person as it relates to companies. We will also find the word juristic person in the rest of that section. So clearly, not only is the word body corporate inconsistent, but it's got totally a different connotation. It should be deleted and it should be substituted by the word juristic person. I've dealt with clause 9 simultaneously with clause 6. I will just skip it over. I will now turn to clause number 10 on our document, Madam Chair. The first one is B, paragraph B, the small Roman 3. Once again, unfortunately, we strictly speaking need to refer to the Principal Act, but if I can just briefly say that what the proposal in small Roman 3 at the bottom of page 4 does is to say that there should be a provision, or companies should be allowed to impose a higher standard of auditing or financial reporting than what is required in this Act. If there is a decision to apply some higher degree of auditing or financial reporting, then they should be permitted to do so. Number two on page 5 of our document, Madam Chair, it's paragraph B, and it's only the omission.
Slow down just a fraction. You know, we're working with 3 documents here. Yeah. And allow you to take some water as well.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I will simply act accordingly. The next one is then page 5, number 2 at the top of page 5, paragraph B. Contain any special. The proposal is that that word special should be deleted and be substituted by the word restrictive. This proposal relates to memorandum of incorporation of companies, where we deal with the so-called ring-fenced provisions. Where we have those ring-fenced provisions, interested parties or shareholders should be alerted to the fact that in the memorandum of incorporation of a specific company, there are special conditions that they should be aware of. But that is the problem. What does special mean? The proposal is that the word restrictive is much more descriptive and explains better what it is that we have in mind here. Where in a memorandum of incorporation, a company has restrictive conditions applicable to the company, those are the ring-fenced ones, then shareholders should be alert and they should take notice of those restrictive conditions. The next one, Madam Chair, is on page 5, number 3, and if I can maybe just ask one of my colleagues, this one was inserted late yesterday afternoon. I can maybe ask one. I see that one of my colleagues that I had in mind have left the room. If you will allow me very briefly, Madam Chair. Please allow me, Madam Chair. Let me just clearly mark it. My apologies for that, Madam Chair. I've got just a single little head, and it's not always where it should be. The next one is a new clause, it's amendment of Section 22 of Act 71, which is the Principal Act. Here, Madam Chair, I need your permission that we specifically refer to Section 22, not in the bill, Section 22 in the new Act. It will not be possible for us to properly reflect on this proposal without having reference to Section 22 in the Principal Act. The heading of that section is reckless trading prohibited. Once again, there has been considerable discussion. If my memory serves me well. The first problem arises in subsection 1A of section 22. It says a company must not carry on its business recklessly with gross negligence with intent to defraud any person or for any fraudulent purpose. So just from reading it, we can clearly see that we are dealing with rather grave kind of circumstances. We are dealing with matters that, in essence, are fraudulent. But then we have lumped together with A in the very same subsection, we have B, trade under insolvent circumstances. So they are categorized together, but clearly I think any reasonable person with respect would appreciate that what we're speaking of in A are much more grave than what we're speaking of in B. Circumstances can easily arise for a company to trade under insolvent circumstances without such company being fraudulent in any manner whatsoever. So the first part of this proposal is to take out, trade under insolvent circumstances from the ambit of subsection 1. And then the proposal is there in our document on page 5 in the middle where it says new clause. Our document, page 5, new clause, amendment of section 22. Now let us see how it will read, should it be accepted. A company must not carry on its business recklessly, intentionally fraudulent purpose, and then we stop. So trading under insolvent circumstances, no longer under the ambit of those ugly ones that we find in subsection 1. In subsection 2, if the commission has a reason, so what do we do now with the insolvent circumstances? We take it down to sub 2. If the commission has reasonable grounds to believe that a company is engaging in conduct prohibited by subsection 1, the fraudulent ones, or is trading under insolvent circumstances, what is the remedy? The commission may issue a notice to the company to show cause why the company should be permitted to continue carrying on its business or to trade as the case may be. So we do not leave the commission remedy-less when it comes to companies trading under insolvent circumstances, but we're taking it out from the ambit of criminal activity. So there is a compliance notice that the commission can send to that company asking why it should be allowed to carry on trading in those kind of circumstances. And then there is in 3, just lower down at the bottom of the page, another proposal that relates to the same principle. If a company to whom a notice has been issued in terms of subsection 2, that is that compliance notice, fails within 20 business days to satisfy the commission that it is not engaging in conduct prohibited by subsection 1, or that it is able to pay its debts as it becomes due and payable in the normal course of business. So that is what the company trading under insolvent circumstances should show to the commission, that it is indeed in a position to pay its debts in the ordinary course of business. I hope Madam Chair, I've been requested just very briefly maybe to refer to the words due and payable, debts due and payable. I can be guided by anyone in this regard, but in law normally we differentiate between a debt becoming due but not necessarily immediately payable. We do find circumstances where debts do arise, so they do become due. The debt is there, but it might only be payable in 30 or 60 days time. That is the only reason for using the words due and payable, merely to differentiate between the debt becoming due and also payable. Needless to say that in most instances, debts will become due and payable simultaneously, maybe on the very same moment. But we do have circumstances where the debt might become due, but not necessarily immediately payable. Madam Chair, the next one is such a small amendment on page 6 of our document. It is on clause 16 of the bill, and it relates to amendment of section 26. There is the only amendment in this provision in the bill. It is page 6, at the top of the page, paragraph B, 4B. It is the omission of the word and, which is the word in bold there at the end of paragraph B, and the substitution or the insertion of the word or. Now, suffice it to say that the difference between these two words can in many instances have vast legal consequences. Because if it is and, then A, B, and C are required. All three of them. If one is missing, the requirement is not satisfied. Whereas if it is all, it can be either one of them, be it A, be it B, or be it C. That is, it is a proposal for amendment of a word, but it's got rather far-reaching consequences. Clearly, if we read this in context with the provision in the Principal Act, or the new Act, we will see that there is a need for the word and to be or. I move on, Madam Chair, to still on page 6 of our document, to clause 18.
Advocate Straden, what are you actually saying about the and? Because you were saying at one point it should be deleted, is that it? And did I hear the continuation of that, that it was to be deleted due to the possibility of misreading it in context?
I'm sorry, Madam Chair. The indication there in B, the word and pardon this kind of, but unfortunately our hands are tied when it comes to this kind of drafting because of the parliamentary requirements as they relate to legislative drafting, but that the word and being in bold square brackets should be omitted, should be deleted from the bill, and that the word or, which is underlined, should be inserted in its place. So the word and will fall away and it will be substituted by the word or, and having totally a different meaning as it relates to this provision in the bill. Thank you, Madam Chair. The next one is clause 18, amendment of section 29. It is there in B. In the case of financial reporting standards, must be consistent with the international financial reporting standards of the International Accounting Standards Board. This is the issue here. If this provision is left as it is in the bill, it would mean that these accounting standards of the IFRS would be applicable to all companies, be they public, be they private, be they for non-profit. Those high standards will apply to all those companies. There was a strong argument made before the Commission, this Honourable Committee, by one of the commentators or a few of the commentators, that these high standards should not apply to private and non-profit companies, but they should apply to public companies. And that is what this proposal, what the effect thereof would be. In the case of financial reporting standards for public companies. So clearly qualifying that these IFRS standards will only apply to public companies. Those others will in fairness be excluded. Madam Chair, if I may then move on to page 7 of our document. And one of my colleagues and will also come in here and be of assistance. It is on clause 19 of the bill. If we read that 2 capital A, the new insertion, we will see that it relates to that circumstance where we find the owner-owned company, not being subject to independent review. What this amendment, this proposal, is suggesting is that it should be very, very clear that where it is owner-owned, there would be no need for independent review. I would like Mr. Netshitenze just to add something on clause 19, Madam Chair.
No, thanks, Chair and Honourable Members. Talking to B, to give it a context, to say during the public hearing and the members interrogating the department officials, it seems as if it was agreed that we should not require companies there should be a demand on companies to be audited, whereas in reality there may not be a need. We gave an example of a contradiction between the Cooperatives Act, which says cooperatives should come with audited statements, and then here we are trying to come with the issue of lessening the regulatory burden, and therefore the two cannot be read together. So if B is conveying a message that we would like companies for no apparent reason to be audited, whereas the Companies Act is coming with a clear message that please reduce this burden. So therefore we are proposing that the committee consider that when we come to the issue of proposing what is it that we want to release these companies not to be audited unnecessarily beyond the threshold of this of this Companies Act. I don't know if it's unclear, but I'm just saying the contradiction is there. We would like to take the regulatory burden, in particular for the cooperatives as an example, and therefore it should not be read that we want to introduce unnecessary regulatory burden through other legislation, which may be defeating the principal act or the law of general application. So can I pause here?
Thank you, Madam Chair. We are still on page 7 of our document. In the middle of the page, new clause. So we do not find a similar provision in the introduced bill. It is a proposal for a new insertion in the bill. It relates to section 31 of our Principal Act. If we refer to section 31 in the Principal Act, we will see the heading is Access to Financial Statements or related information, which is a very important right that a shareholder or other interested party should be allowed to exercise. The proposal in this new clause is that a new subsection 4 should be inserted in section 31 in the Principal Act to make it very clear that it would be an offence to deny the kind of access to anybody that section 31 provides for. Needless to say, this is not a common law offence. So if an Act of Parliament would provide for a statutory offence to make it criminal for this kind of conduct, then there must be a prohibition, and not only a prohibition, but also a penalty relating to that prohibition. Then it becomes a criminal statutory offence. That is the effect of the proposal under the new clause on section 31. That if a company would fail to provide this kind of important information, in effect, an offence would be committed. Madam Chair, the next one is on page 8 of our document. It relates to clause.
Chairperson, sorry. Thank you, Chairperson. I know when you discussed in the beginning how we're going to deal with this act and how far, I would urge you for it not to go too far so that we maybe can break this whole 14-page document maybe into three sections, and then we give the committee members just maybe time to deal with certain issues. Otherwise, it might just get a bit too long at the end, and we can rather focus on certain sections and then go on. I beg you on that indulgence, please, ma'am.
In fact, I had hoped when we were going through, other than the clause that had not yet been dealt with, that we would get up to page 9 or so in this document here. In the latest document, we have received as responses and suggestions and recommendations. So you won't overlook your colleague's input. You know, he was absent or perhaps not just at his desk. Thank you. So if you would consider, you know, as it were, just pausing at the end of, just before clause 40 on your page 9, but having also allowed for that input.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair. If I can maybe, with your permission, I think it might be fair if I request Mr. Dwinger to respond to the outstanding one, which is on page 5 of our document, and it is number 3. Page 5 of our document, it is number 3. And maybe in the very same vein, also to make some comment in respect of clause 23 in our document, page 18. That is the differentiation between certificated and uncertificated shares and the depository registries and so forth. Clause 23 on page 8, and then the one that was outstanding. With your permission, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Chair. Clause 10, as was explained, the first part of it, where in paragraph 1 of the document there, on page 4, a new 3 is introduced, imposing on the company a higher standard or a greater restriction, a longer period, or a more onerous requirement than the access. This section, the introduction of this new 3, will have the effect that the company may introduce additional requirements over and above what the Act states for certain activities in its MOI. Now, 3, on the next page, on the paragraph 3, a new insertion is also made, and that goes hand in hand with the First Amendment. the First Amendment in the deal for the insertion of a new paragraph, Roman 3. So, D relates to that. If you look at the last words, contemplated in paragraph A3, so it just states that such, let me just get the wording of the section correct. They go hand in hand. So that the prohibition would not include what is now inserted under 3. So they are the last one is basically a consequential amendment. You just get the section of the act at hand. I think that will be make it easier to understand. Subsection 2 of Section 15 of the Principal Act says the memorandum of incorporation of any company may include any provision, one, dealing with a matter that this Act does not address, or altering the effect of any altering provision of the Act, and then we add the 3, imposing a higher standard or a greater restriction. So that is the new amendment. Now, when we go to subsection 2 at the D, it will just merely state the memorandum of incorporation of the company may not include any provision that negates, restricts, limits, qualifies, extends, or otherwise alters the substance or effect of an alterable provision except to the extent contemplated in the new paragraph 3. So it's a total, it makes it clear that alterable provisions cannot be changed in the MOI unless that change as the result of a stricter requirement or a higher standard that's being introduced by the MOI. Clause 23 on page 8. The clause 23 of the Bill Act intends to fill an omission in the current Companies Act by providing for when rights that are acquired in securities actually are transferred to the holder of that securities. And clause 23 then provides that it goes over to the new shareholder or securities holder once it is entered into the company securities register. Straight when during their presentations before this committee made it clear that the company securities register is not sufficient to deal with all types of shares. And they indicated the difference between certificated shares and uncertificated shares. One is the paper document that can be done or which can be included in registers kept by the company, and the other one is dealt with at the Central Securities Depository. It's electronic register.
Is it Advocate Duma?
That's correct.
Advocate Duma, you know, we also want our content specialist to be on top of it, apart from the chair, who's also not on top of it. So, let's just, you're still dealing with page 5. Because I thought you'd gone to page 8.
No, Chair, I've already shifted to clause 23, yes.
Ah, all right. So now, at least by some chance, I found myself on page 8 anyway. But, so is everyone then on the new, you know, the page 8 of what we've just been given? Right.
Thank you, Chair. As I said, the essence of the proposal that the DPI now makes as a consequential to the straight representations is that we draw the proper distinction between certificated securities register and the securities central securities depository where uncertificated securities are kept on the register electronically. There are different rules applying to the two sets of registers, and this proposed amendment here would only take cognizance of the difference between the two sets of, or the two types of securities register that one find. Thank you, Chair.
With your permission, Madam Chair, I will then you, before we take the little break for issues to be raised, with the last proposal, which is on clause 29. It's on page 8, at the bottom of the page there, dealing with section 48 in the introduced bill. Without reading this proposal, we will see that it relates to the issue of the buyback of shares, where certain transactions are done by a company that equate to buying back shares. If the provision would remain as is, it would have the effect of ordinary preferential redeemable shares, that their redemption by a company would be considered or be regarded as buyback of shares. Whereas the very nature and essence of a redeemable share is in the word redeemable, that somewhere in the future there will be a redemption of the value of that share. That is the very essence of those shares. And why should that redemption, that future redemption of that preferential share, be regarded as a buyback? The proposal here, if it would agree to by this Honourable Committee, would have the effect of those redeemable shares and their redemption in future not being regarded as a buyback of shares as anticipated in this provision. Madam Chair, that brings us to the top of page 9 before we get to clause 40. We will be glad then to take a breather if you would allow the honourable members maybe to raise certain issues that we have dealt with so far.
I've only just caught up myself. Thank you very much. Honourable members, now we've gone through page 8 on what we just heard, as you see the top of page 9. Are there any queries, questions, and remember about keeping it brief now. We're still coming to the broader deliberations, all right? Thank you.
Thank you. Just to come back to the clauses or the actual definitions of the words, the meaning of those words, if for one reason that it's been taken out, and we referred previously that the Companies Act subscribes to the other financial acts that we've mentioned, those 8 or 9 acts that there are. If those words are amended, does that mean, and they are deleted in this act, does that mean, in short, if it's not there, it goes towards, it falls, if the meaning is somewhere else, like the Administration Act, it will reveal, their understanding comes from there. First, in short, on that clause.
That was certainly within the time constraint. Thank you. Honourable Ambrosini.
Is it 1 minute, Madam Chair? Okay. I'll make some statements, you answer to them, because this was the minute that allows me to. Clause 2, if you delete what the amendment was trying to do, you go back to the meaning of you go back to the bill, you're left with the problem of holding the entire aggregate accountable for the single. Shouldn't just the entire reference to holding company go away? And basically, when a company is belly up, it's belly up and doesn't carry anyone, as it is in most jurisdictions of the world. Clause 3, I think that this is either pleonastic or unconstitutional. These things of giving laws a different status in terms of passive resistance doesn't quash the same problem with PIAT, with many other laws passed by this parliament, and that entire section should be removed. Then page 5 and 3, again, that's pleonastic. It's provided in other part of the bill where the definition of unalterable provision is set out. A new clause, then page 4, all this, okay, I'll skip this because this takes time. On the, on 6, you need to put an A, on page 6, first one, the end goes in between the first two, then the or. And then my last point, Madam.
I'm not, you know, if nobody can understand on the side that you're expecting a response, we'd have a problem. That's what I'm trying to caution you.
Sorry, they didn't understand it.
Just a minute.
Where?
You were trying to get my attention, DDG, on...
No, we were getting lost, Chair, so I think he was moving a bit fast, the honourable member, so we asked him to just slow down so that we can understand the question.
Well, I can't have got 1 minute, so trying to count.
All we're asking for is keep it to the two, because I can see you will already overextend just at the moment. Can you just...
can I make one more point? One more point. May I make one more point?
DDG, do you need them all? Do you need the honourable member to go over all of them again?
Checklist?
Yes. Okay. Thank you.
Can I go over again? Okay. Can I? Okay. Okay. I'm going through your document. Clause 2. If I understand correctly, you're eliminating the proposed amendment, so you go back to what the bill says. That leaves the bill problematic. The problematic aspect of the bill is that you make sound company accountable for unsound company, undermining the notion of corporate liability and separation of company. Why not just eliminating the entire notion of holding the holding company accountable for the subsidiaries as it is in most jurisdictions? Then let me then skip to, because otherwise we're cutting off, to clause 18 on page on page 6. You see, to me the problem here is not in respect of what standards apply to the to public company or private companies, where the reference should be made to the international reporting standards of the International Accounting Board. If we eliminate here the reference to we make this applicable for public companies, the question then arises what standards would apply in respect on the non-public company. To me here the real issue, which is what emerged from the submission, what makes sense is to redress this absurdity that all companies are required to be audited irrespective of need. So if that is addressed in the provision where the obligation arises, this is this consequential amendment is not required. Then I was just pointing out on the same page that on the issue of the end or or, between A and B you need an end, and then between B and C there is an or, otherwise it doesn't work. The, on... Yeah, no, it's...
You need the same page.
Yes, amendment to section 26. I mean, that's just technical, that'll pick it up. Then on the other issue, and this is also technical, of this trying to give a greater passive resistance in point of amendments to legislation, it doesn't work. It's either null and void as unconstitutional. And here we are making more laws. There is only one class of laws under the South African Constitution, and that are the laws. So if it is a matter of interpretation, fact, but it is a matter of purporting one law having a greater capacity of resisting amendment by subsequent laws, can't do that.
I think certainly when it comes time to responding, we haven't forgotten you, Honourable Harris, the department may seek a further clarification, but let's just leave it there for the moment. Honourable Harris?
Thanks, Chair. Chair, if I could just request that we do, since we've just got the documents, the questions that I have on these clauses do not cover everything that I have in all of these pieces of paper around me, so I hope we get another opportunity to engage with it like this. But just to start, just two issues. the new clause to amend Section 22 of Act 71, which is page 5 of the new document. It deals with the issue around commercial versus technical insolvency, and I see the proposal is that this clause or this addition under the underlined line near the bottom, where the company is able to pay debts as it becomes due and payable in the normal course of business. I'm concerned that, you know, when it comes to commercial solvency, the issue is about being able to cover operating expenses. I'm concerned that the definition of debt there, I'm not an accountant, but if the company is able to cover its debt, that's far broader than the idea of covering their operating expenses. So it leaves us the same problem around the definition of commercial versus technical insolvency. So I can see what the proposal is trying to achieve, but I'm not sure that the company being able to pay debt sufficiently clarifies the issue around commercial insolvency versus technical insolvency. And then on the next page, page 6, I can see why we've amended that, especially to change the and into an or. This is clause 16, the PIA clause. The two issues that were raised in the hearing. The one is anybody would also need the ability to copy the records rather than just view them. So perhaps section 26.2 needs to be amended to include the word copy there. And also, do we not need, relating to the request in section 24.6b, do we not need a time limit in terms of when that request needs to be honored? Would we not need to add another clause there that provides for that?
Right. Thank you very much, honorable members. Over to DTI. Just a quick point here. We may well even just have a kind of running tea break in our running shoes. Let me see. Yeah. Okay. Over to DTI, please.
Thank you, Chair. The team will address the issues that have been raised. But I just want to say, Chair, that obviously some of the questions that are being put to us, we have just brought in proposals. And I think some of them will just take them as comments from the members just to direct us also in terms of our proposals. Because, like we said, these are proposals. I think the committee still will have its opportunity to say what needs to go into the amendment when we deal with the A bill. But I'll hand over to the team here quickly.
No, thanks. I'm dealing with what Honorable Harris has raised. And as the DDG said, that this is a proposal, the issue of time limits, I think. Time limits, in our view, it won't do any harm if we add such. I mean, it's a proposal. So I think that is not the word acceptable is not proper, but we are saying we seem to be agreeing that there should be time limits in the clause. And then the copy part of it, So I was also being advised that we are in sync because it says in a prescribed manner. We don't want to take everything to the regulation, but the regulation can also come with a solution. But if the Honorable Committee wants to say, let's deal with it here, then that can also be proper, but we are in our hands. Thanks. The other issues, maybe my colleagues, Brenner will also, and Rory will also assist for Honorable Ambrosin in particular.
Madam Chair, if I may, up to a short certain point, try and be fair in responding, and then maybe request where I do not fill in the gaps that my colleagues would assist me. If I can, first of all, to refer to the issue that was raised in respect of definitions. For instance, the definition of master. So far we've had the experience in this exercise as well, where we end up with inconsistencies. We will later on, in these proposals, get to a very serious inconsistency that has arisen in this bill in respect of void and voidable transactions. So needless to say, we need to try and to do our utmost not to create inconsistencies, especially as they relate to definitions. Because the moment you define a concept, then wherever that word is to be found in the Act, we will be obliged by law to follow that definition solely without any qualification. So, for instance, the definition of master. If we would have defined master separately in the New Companies Act, we would have had to make very, very sure that that definition is not inconsistent with another Act of Parliament, and maybe foremost in that other Act of Parliament that primarily deals with most of the functions and duties performed by the master, which is the administration of a state's act. So the convenient and possibly the more safe way of doing it is merely to say in this definition that we are latching on to the definition of master where we find it in the administration of a state's act. If maybe subsequently there would be an amendment to that definition in the administration of a state's act, we would not have to amend anything in the Companies Act, because this is merely a reference of the definition to the master. I'm not sure whether it covers the whole issue that has been raised. If not, we will gladly try to be fair later on. Allow me to go, Madam Chair, to one of the matters that has been raised by the Honourable Ambrosini in respect of Section 4 of the Principal Act. It is Clause 2 in the bill, but it relates to Section 4 in the New Companies Act, the heading being Solvency and Liquidity Test. In order to fully appreciate this amendment, we need to read the preceding words in Section 4, Sub 1 of the new Act. Once again, your reading is better than mine, but for any purpose of this Act, a company satisfies the solvency and liquidity test at a particular time if considering all reasonably foreseeable financial circumstances of the company at that point in time, and here we have the problem that we are trying to address in this proposal. A, paragraph A, is the very provision that we have in this document under clause 2. What we are saying, and if we are correct, is if paragraph A remains, that is the very paragraph that lumps all the single companies in a family or group of companies together for purposes of the application of the solvency and liquidity test. It is actually the consequence of paragraph A in the Act to say that if five companies do not meet the test, the other five financially viable ones are equally in trouble. So the proposal is that paragraph A should be deleted from the Act. And the effect of that would be that the companies within that group or family, that the test will be applied to each one of them individually, irrespective of the financial status of the others. Madam Chair, my colleague is indicating that he can add to the CAP.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In response to the Honourable Harris, concerning the issue of the copying of the documents, if you look at Section 26 of the Principal Act, and you look under the offence clause contained within that particular provision, you will see an implied provision of copy, where it says that it is an offence to inspect, to not to allow inspection or copying of the documents. So it's an implied provision that copying is allowed of the particular documents upon inspection of those particular areas. Response to the Honourable Ambrosini concerning the issue of the provision requiring that public companies use the standard of IFRS in preparation of their financial statements, and the question is what standards will be used for others. If you look at the provision in the Principal Act in 29.5C, it states that in 5 as a whole, it says that regulations will contemplate the making of particular standards for different types of companies, whereby the regulations will take cognizance of the fact that the various standards are required for different categories of companies, and therefore it will be provided within those particular regulations accordingly.
To have dealt with almost all of the issues. We have one small outstanding issue here that's just been raised. Honourable Smalley.
Thank you. I just would like to refer to their page 5, the new clause as well. The process of, it's a suggestion as well, the process of appeal of the clause 2 has actually been implemented. Or actually, where does a company actually appeal to this process if he's not happy with the outcome of the commission? That's just a suggestion that I would like to make within that 20 days. How do we, is regulations here, there, if I can be referred to that, thank you.
If I can respond to the Honourable Smaller. There is a general power of appeal to the body called the Companies Tribunal. It is an oversight body of the work of the Commission as well as any other issues where companies have disputes amongst themselves. There is a right for directors as well as companies to take those types of disputes to the body called the Companies Tribunal. So if it is a dispute within the fact that they want to respond to a compliance notice as issued by the Companies Commission regarding their trading status or their status as regards reckless trading, they have the right to go in and appeal to the Companies Tribunal as to the work that has been done by the Companies Commission.
Members, we could just carry on for a short while because we do have the time. We were on the top of, from what I could just look at here, we were about to start clause 40. Is that correct? On page 9. Let's deal with that and try and deal with that and clause 41 at the very least. Is T here? Yes, fine. 40 and 41.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Clause 40 relates to Section 65 of the Principal Act. It proposes a substitution for subsection 11, which is the penultimate subsection of Section 65. So it's in the Principal Act. Section 65, subsection 11. It says, a special resolution is required to, and then it lists A, B, and C. So, in the instance of A, B, and C, a special resolution is required to perform that act or transaction. Now we can see that the proposal is here to to add quite a number of other instances where a special resolution by a company would be required to perform certain acts. They are all listed here. I would, in the interest of time, not read them all, but that is the essence of this proposal, that if it would be accepted, special resolutions would not only be required in the case of 65 sub 11 A, B and C, but in all of these instances. Just allow me to remain for a moment on the same clause and mention something that is not reflected in this proposal, but maybe should be considered. The immediate issue that arises is this list now exhaustive? Is it a completely exhaustive list? In the sense that it is only in these instances where a special resolution is required. So if it is anything that does not fall within the ambit of this list, then no special resolution is required. That might be risky. There might well be other instances where special resolutions should, in fairness, be required, but then they're not listed in this exhaustive list. So we would like to leave it in the midst of this honourable committee to consider maybe the drafting of a so-called catch-all clause, just maybe to the effect of saying that, or making it clear that this list is not an exclusive list, that there might be other instances not named in this list where special resolutions might be required, and then so be it. Madam Chair, the last one before we break is on clause 41. I won't read it once again. The effect is fairly simple. The only aim of this proposal is to give clarity to the effect that a director of a certain company might in certain instances serve in more than one capacity in or more than one committee of a company. We find it there right at the end of the insertion. Any particular director of a company may be appointed to more than one committee of a company and in that sense serve in dual capacity. If it is not inserted, it might well be argued that dual capacity serving would not be permissible. If I can leave it at that, Madam Chair.
All right, members, we are breaking for 15 minutes. I think that watch there is about, I see it's 5 to 11 there, and mine says 11 o'clock. So if we could be back here, please, at 10 past 11 on that watch, or quarter past on mine. Thank you. If we can just get back to the matter in hand. I just want this to sit through. Thank you very much, DTI. We're on page 10 of your document, clause 43. Now, we're going to proceed pretty swiftly on this. We all know how the system works now. So I will immediately hand over back to DTI. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's page 10 of our document, clause 43. Once again, this one has been discussed at length. And, Madam Chair, thank you so much. I can now hopefully be a bit fairer to you. I have now also taken one of the copies of the Principal Act that was made available here this morning, so I will no longer refer to my own copy of the Principal Act, the pages of which do not correspond to the one that was made available here this morning. So if I now refer to the pages of the Principal Act, we will all be on the same page, literally. Clause 43 on page 10, Madam Chair, it relates to section 69 of the Principal Act, which is on page 136. Page 136. Right at the bottom of page 136, and there is this provision. Needless to say, this provision is currently in the introduced bill, indicating, of course, certain amendments to the provision. Subsection 12, right at the bottom, despite being disqualified in terms of subsection 8B3 or 4, a person may act as a director of a private company if all of the shares of that company are held by that disqualified person alone or by that person, and then in B, persons related to that person. This is the owner business scenario that we have been discussing. What we have in subsection 8 are those offences that disqualify a director from serving in that capacity within a company. But then we do not make it a blanket provision as the bill stands at the moment. We are saying that we have the owner business, the single director, and maybe a few other directors related to that single director, then those disqualifications in subsection 8 do not apply to that owner business. There was a very strong sentiment within this Honourable Committee that what was the rationale for allowing a single director to act as a director of an owner business irrespective of those disqualifications that we have in sub 8. Shouldn't we rather make it a general blanket kind of provision applying to all directorships? There was also, part of the argument was also that we are mistaken in assuming that an owner business is necessarily a small business. Or even maybe assuming that because it's a small business that there can be no prejudice or harm to the public in conducting that business with respect. That is clearly not the case. We can be well aware of the fact that there are certain single owner businesses that are not necessarily small, and we cannot necessarily say that they do not hold harm or prejudice for the public in conducting their business. So here is the proposal, Madam Chair, in clause 43 of our document on page 10. We can simply see there that the whole of subsection 12, as we find it currently in the introduced bill, being struck through, the proposal being, or the end effect or the net effect would be that subsection 12 in the Principal Act would be omitted in its entirety, and that the disqualifications in subsection 8 would apply to all directors, irrespective and regardlessly. The In B, right at the bottom of page 10, the deletion of subsection 12. There it is. I hope I've been fair on this one, Madam Chair. The net effect simply being that if you're a director of a company, be it big, be it small, be it single director O, you will be subject to those disqualifications, especially if we keep in mind, if we read those disqualifications in subsection 8, we will see that mostly they relate to offences where dishonesty has been an element, or where the integrity, unfortunate, of the person involved has been impaired. The next one, I almost feel slightly embarrassed in referring to the next one on our document, page 8, Madam Chair, clause 48. Please allow me not to say anything on it, Madam Chair. There it is. The word it apostrophe s, should be x without the apostrophe s. I'm slightly embarrassed to do that, but be that as it may. Madam Chair, the next one is on clause 50. Of our document, it is the amendment of section 84 in the Principal Act. Without reading it once again, if you would allow me to explain what would be the result if this proposal is accepted. If we do refer to section 84 in the Act, which is on page 162, at the bottom there, and the heading application of chapter. This chapter applies to, and then we have C right at the bottom, a private company, a personal liability company, or a non-profit company, only to the extent contemplated in that section. So we have a limitation in application of certain chapters or provisions of the Principal Act. The effect, if this proposal is accepted by this committee, would be that in those instances where companies subject to voluntary auditing, where they subject to voluntary auditing, that this proviso that we have here in the small Roman 1 would not be, those parts of the Act would not be applicable on those companies where they subject to voluntary auditing, and if we refer to those parts, we will see they relate to the company having to have a secretary and having to have an audit committee. So this proposal would like companies subjecting voluntarily to audit not to be encumbered by having to have a secretary and an audit committee. If I may move to clause 54 at the bottom of page 11 of our document. Once again, without reading, Madam Chair, it relates to section 94 in the Principal Act. It is section 94 sub 7, which is right at the bottom of page 174. And we have to go to the next page in the middle there. There's a small I, just above the middle. That small I in brackets on page 176. So if we read the preceding words, it will say, an audit committee of a company has the following duties. And then here at the bottom of page 11, to perform other functions determined by the board. And then we exclude the rest of the words. The effect would be that this would make it very clear that these committees have an oversight function. If we leave these bold words in brackets in the bill, it creates the impression that these committees have more than an oversight function. Madam Chair, the next one on page 12 is a new clause that is being proposed. It relates to section 99. It's got a very simple operation. There we can see in B, page 12 of our document, new clause, that paragraph B. In the case of a foreign company, a copy of its memorandum of incorporation or comparable governing document. Those words to be inserted. The reason being that in some foreign jurisdictions, we will find companies having these kind of documents being called, spade being called by another name, so to speak, so that they do not have reference to memorandum of incorporation. Then we would like to have a comparable governing document that is compatible to what we understand to be a memorandum of incorporation. Madam Chair, the next one is on clause 73. And pardon this little reference, it almost looks like the kind of reference that we will eventually see in the A bill. If we go to page 38 of the bill, of the introduced bill, page 38 of the introduced bill, it is from line 36, so it's on page 38 of the bill, it's clause 73, clause 73, and the proposal is that the whole of paragraph B should be deleted because of that reference to the 50%. Page 38 of the bill, clause 73, paragraph B. If I may request that one of my colleagues quickly just to refer to the rationale for this proposal.
Thank you, Chair. The specified percentage referred to in the prescribed percentage, sorry, referred to in section 123 of the Companies Act is the percentage that normally would trigger an offer to minority shareholders in a takeover situation of companies. Under the current situation, that percentage is fixed at 35%. So in other words, any offer, if a person acquires 35% or more of any company's shares, he is compelled to make an offer for the remaining shares of that company as well. If the percentage is now fixed in the Act to 50%, it will severely prejudice minority shareholders and companies. So in other words, if a person now acquires 45 or 49% of a company's share, it would not have to make a comparable offer to the minority shareholders at the best price paid for any of those shares. Sorry. It is also, the prescribed percentage is also mentioned in various places, other places in the said section, and we can only gather that some oversight that caused the 50% to slip in this specific amendment, and therefore we propose that we rather just scrap this whole proposal to amend this specific section.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I will deal very, very briefly with clause 75, page 12 of our document. It's got paragraphs A and B, and there is the only amendment, it's a minor one. It's in the second line. The word reacquires should be a hyphenated word. There is nothing more to it than that, Madam Chair. Just to make sure reacquires is hyphenated. The next one, Madam Chair, is on page 13 of our document, relating to section 133 of the Act. Section 133 is on page 238. 238 of the Act. And I need, in fairness, just to make a little reference to this one, Madam Chair. It is important that we reflect on the preceding words in section 133, sub 1. So where 133 starts on page 238. During business rescue proceedings, no legal proceeding, including enforcement action, against the company or in relation to any property belonging to the company or lawfully in its possession, may be commenced or proceeded with in any forum except. So the essence of this is to say that when business rescue proceedings have commenced, these other kind of proceedings referred to in section 133 will in a sense be stopped, or they will be suspended whilst the rescue proceedings are in place. Except in these kind of exceptions listed from A to E. Now, the problem that is arisen here is what would be the case if a regulatory authority, let's say for instance, maybe SARS, would have books or documents of a company in its possession in the execution of its statutory duties in terms of its enabling act, and now they're confronted by the business rescue practitioner saying, on the basis of this, my proceedings override yours, let me have the books. Here is the proposal. So except, and then clause 18, page 13 of our document, proceedings by a regulatory authority in the execution of its mandatory functions, after such regulatory authority, there is a spelling mistake, it should be authority Y apostrophe S, notification to the business rescue practitioner. The consequence simply being that on the basis of this proposal, SARS would not, or any other regulatory authority, would not be obstructed or frustrated in performing their duties based on an act of Parliament because of the business rescue proceedings. Madam Chair, I then move on to clause 83. It relates to section 136. This is in the bill, clause 83 in our bill. I am even more embarrassed now. The first one in paragraph A, by the insertion paragraph A of subsection 1, after the word proceedings where it first appears, of A, comma. I would not say anything further on that one, Madam Chair. The next one is, it's clause 83, page 41 of our bill, page 41 of the introduced bill, it's paragraph B. And in that section 2, capital A, just above the middle of page 41 in the bill, when acting in terms of subsection 2, and then we go to a business rescue practitioner must not suspend any provision of small Roman 2, an agreement to which section 35A or B of the Insolvency Act applies. It should not be applies, but would have applied if the company was liquidated. So the only proposal is to delete the word applies and to substitute would have applied if the company was liquidated. Madam Chair, the next one is on page 14 of our document. Once again, it's a new clause. It does not relate to an existing clause in the bill. Section 140. If we refer to section 140 in our principal acts on page 244, right at the bottom, general powers and duties of practitioners. Once again, we will see if we read this, that it relates to the interrelationship between the business rescue practitioner and regulatory authorities. do not want them to go past one another, or the one hand maybe not knowing about the other hand. So that is why this is the following proposal, that it should be inserted under the duties then, that the practitioner must, as soon as practicable after appointment, inform all relevant regulatory authorities, having authority in respect of the activities of the company, of the fact that the company has been placed under business rescue proceedings, and of his or her appointment. The idea simply being that the practitioner and the regulatory authorities should be aware of one another in performing their different respective functions. If I can move on, Madam Chair, to the next one, new clause. This is amendment of section 141 in our Principal Act. It's section 141 on page 246. 246, and we're dealing here with subsection 2. Subsection 2 of section 141. And in more particular, that's more, I'm sorry, Madam Chair, it's section 141, paragraph C. Paragraph C, it's in line 50 there, closer to the bottom of the page. And then the small Roman 1. So it reads, if at any time during business rescue proceedings, the practitioner concludes that, and then in C, there is evidence in the dealings of the company before the business rescue proceedings began of, so there is evidence of, voidable transactions, or a failure by the company or any director to perform any material obligation relating to the company, and then these words, the practitioner must direct the management to take any necessary steps. So if there is evidence of voidable transactions, the practitioner has no discretion. He or she must direct the company to take the necessary steps. The argument was made that this is too mandatory on the part of the practitioner. The practitioner, where it is in the interest, in the better interest of the company, the practitioner should have a discretion in what to refer to the management. It is not always in the interest of a company, in the case of voidable transactions, that all those cases must be referred to the management of the company. Sometimes they can be dealt with better through other means. And that is the effect of this proposal, right at the bottom of page 14 of our document. So where there's voidable transactions and the rest, the practitioner must, we take out, direct the management to, must take any necessary steps to rectify the matter based on his or her discretion, and may direct the management to take appropriate steps. So we're not taking the management of the company out of the equation. We're just giving a discretion to the practitioner to refer a matter to management, as opposed to make it mandatory for him or her to do it. Madam Chair, the next one was also the subject of considerable debate. It's on page 15 of our document, clause 86. It relates to section 142 in the Act, which is on page 248. We can just read it in isolation as it appears here in our document. Page 15 of our document, clause 86, no person is entitled, as against the practitioner of a company, to retain possession of any books or records of the company, or to claim or enforce a lien over any such books or records. That is the current provision in the bill, and there is the problem. If, for instance, let's assume that an accountant has performed certain duties for a company, and the company has failed to pay the account. accountant for doing his books, then by law, the accountant would be entitled to retain those books on the basis of a lien until the fees for auditing the books have been paid to the accountant. Now, as the provision stands, needless to say, there are many other possibly better examples. Once again, maybe the one that we referred to earlier on SARS. But fact of the matter is that if that person is now approached by the rescue practitioner, the right of the practitioner will simply override the lawful lien that the other person has in respect of the books. So the operation of this provision is really to negate a lawful right that a person has in those circumstances. So this is the proposal, unless such books or records are in the lawful possession of such person, and he or she has made copies available to the practitioner, or has afforded the practitioner the opportunity to inspect the books or records concerned. So the practitioner should also be happy to inspect or make copies. And here it is, clause 87, Madam Chair, relating to section 143, we do not need to refer to the Principal Act. We can simply reflect on what we're having here. The word egregiously, which definitely was not part of my mother tongue, it is said that this has got, it rings a foreign bell. It has no standing on our statute books. We did make the trouble to refer to a dictionary to see what are the synonymous words to be found for egregiously, words like grossly or in the extreme or that kind of thing. The proposal is that the word egregiously should be deleted and that we simply stick to the norm of reasonableness. Madam Chair, in fairness to the committee, I need to point out that the next amendment on clause 105, page 16 of our document, is not part of the introduced bill, nor, if my memory serves me well, flows from any submissions that were made during the public hearings. But it has been pointed out to us that we must submit this for consideration to this Honourable Committee. There it is, clause 105, page 16. It relates to section 194 of the Act. This was also not part of our document of the 28th of January that was discussed with this committee. It is section 194, page 320 of the new Act. Now, if we read, no, I'm not going to do that, but if we read section 194, we will see that it makes provision for ministerial appointments to the tribunal, the chairperson and other members of that body. But it has no reference to the term of office, like we normally find in most acts of parliament dealing with appointments to these kind of statutory institutions. So the term of office has been left open-ended. There is no limit on the term of office. So from that basis, the proposal in clause 105, page 16 of the document, the chairperson and each other member of the tribunal serves for a term of 5 years and may, subject to subsection 2B, be reappointed to a second term. The reference to 2B is necessary because if we read section 194, sub 2B, line 15, page 320, it says a person may not be reappointed to a second term as chairperson of the tribunal. So all members, if this would be accepted, all members would be eligible for serving a second term, but the chair of the tribunal would not be eligible for serving a second term. Madam Chair, if I may quickly ask one of my colleagues to just, I may just need to refer to something here, Madam Chair. Please, Madam Chair, if I can ask one of my colleagues just to fill me in quickly on clause 109. I'm sorry, Madam Chair, I am back in the picture, I hope. I think I can continue. It is on page 17 of our document. It is the proposed omission of that paragraph I, just above the middle of page 17. The body that is envisaged here, that one person nominated by the body, governing the regulation of the accounting professions. That body is the Accounting Practices Board. The Accounting Practices Board. And that board will cease to exist when this Act comes into operation. It will no longer be in existence subsequent to the commencement of the new Act. And therefore, this paragraph I find no application whatsoever. Madam Chair, the next one is clause 112. Once again, pardon this reference here, Madam Chair. It refers to our bill, the introduced bill, on page 49.
Thanks, Chair. Let's go back to page 16 of the bill. Of the proposal. Clause 109. Page 16. And then C, 203C, it reads 2%. These are the representatives of the in the council, and then C says 2% responsible for preparing financial statements for private companies, and then if we may add or personal liability companies, we have three types of companies, so we're just adding or personal liability companies. They should also. They may also have a representative. That's all that we are adding. Okay. Johan will take over. I was just reminding him that we disagree.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I see we're moving closer to the end of the document now. Clause 112, page 17 of our document. Can we refer to page 49 of the bill, the introduced bill? Page 49 of the bill serving before this committee. 49. It is on page 49, line 24. It is just about the middle of the page. Paragraph C says, was knowingly a party to an act or omission by a business. We're not dealing here with businesses, we're dealing with companies. It was an omission. The word business should be a company. If we read on, we will see that the word company is there. There was no justification for the word business there. There's nothing more to it, Madam Chair. There is a little more substance in the next one. which is on clause 1.1c. Without repeating our little discussion of the other day, but just for the sake of proper reflection, we have in section 78, maybe it might well be necessary in fairness, Madam Chair, to rather refer to section 218 in the Act. It's on page 340. And it is subsection 1 immediately that raises the problem. Nothing in this Act renders void an agreement. And then I'm leaving out the middle part, we go to the end, which says, unless a court declares that agreement, resolution, or provision to be void. There is nothing ambiguous about this provision. It clearly says that nothing in this Act renders void an agreement unless a court of law has ordered so. The problem is, in section 78, in section 78 of the Act, which is on page 154, the problem here is consistency or incompatibility of two provisions in the very same Act. Section 78, page 154, subsection 2 says, subject to section so and so, any provision of an agreement, memorandum of incorporation, or rules of a company, so on, and then, is void to the extent that it directly or indirectly purports to relieve a director of a duty contemplated in section 75, and another reference as well. So, let us reflect in isolation on 78.2 and see what is the legal consequence. Once again, there's no ambiguity in 78 subsection 2. It says clearly, if a memorandum of incorporation of a company incorporates this kind of thing that we have in section 75 or in section 77, that memorandum of that company is void right from the outset. Those ugly words, ab initio. Right from its inception, it is dead. It's got no legal consequence. Now that is directly in conflict with what we're having in 218. Because 218 says that nothing in this Act declares void anything unless there has been an order of court. So the operation of section 218 in respect of section 78 would be that irrespective of this memorandum of incorporation containing this ugly thing, there will have to be an application to court declaring that memorandum, and all the concomitant costs as well, declaring that memorandum of incorporation void. There must be harmony now. We need to bring harmony between these two conflicting provisions. And here it is, and the reading is maybe not necessarily reader-friendly, Madam Chair, but this is what we would like to propose for the time being. It is on page 17, right at the bottom, page 17 of our document, clause 113. We insert now the following. Subject to any provision in this Act, specifically declaring void an agreement, resolution, or provision of an agreement, memorandum of incorporation, or rules of a company, and then we just carry on. So, Madam Chair, that is the proposal. that we insert those words there. So the effect of this proposal, if accepted, would be that where, for instance, in section 78.2, there is a specific declaration by this Act of something being void, it will be respected. That if there would be no need to approach the court of law to have it declared. Stop my microphone in the process here, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, before I deal with the last two proposals, can I ask one of my colleagues, whilst I take a drop of water, to deal with clause 118, and thereafter I will simply deal with the last two proposals. Just to deal with clause 118.
Thanks, the Honourable Member. Clause 118 is talking, per se, as it was said during the public hearing, that when the act comes into being, there will maybe problems that certain companies auditing annual financial year will have a gap, and then we explain to say those companies whose annual end come say before the commencement of this act. An example was 1 April 2011. That was an example. To say it ends in December 2010 as an example, they should adopt the 1973 Act and continue, and it runs its course until their annual financial year comes to an end. Those other ones, it will have an effect, say, on 1st of April 2011, and the need to apply the new act, and then go on. I think that is what our drafters are telling us here. They can simplify. I'm not a drafter, but I talk at the high level. So that's what is written here. Johan, do you want to be pedantic? And I'm not pedantic and be vicious.
I'll simply carry on with your permission, Madam Chair. Can we turn to some page 18 still? Amendment of Schedule 5 of Act 71. This is in our document. Can we please refer, Madam Chair, to the Principal Act, page 384. Page 384, in line 38. It is item 6, sub item 3. Hey, sometimes these references are very cumbersome, Madam Chair. So there we are, page 384. Line 38. It says, it might be necessary just briefly to read it. The Minister, in consultation with a member of the Cabinet responsible for national financial matters, and then, there is the word must again, must make regulations to take effect and so forth, and here we go on, providing for the transitional status and conversion of any nominal or par value shares. I can stop there. The argument has been made that if any reasonable person would read this, it creates the impression that the minister is obliged, must, to make regulations providing for the conversion of nominal or par value shares. Now, clearly, that has never been the intention. The new dispensation in terms of this Act would no longer permit companies after commencement to issue par value shares. But that does not mean that the existing par value shares, that companies should be obliged to convert those par value shares into non-par value shares. So from there, the proposal in our document, bottom of page 80, providing for, and then we put in the following words, the optional conversion and transitional status of any nominal or par value shares. To make it very clear that if there's conversion by companies of par value shares, it will not be mandatory, it will indeed be optional or discretionary.
Through you, Chair. Therefore, all proposals by FACER, as an example, is that when people optionally say choose, optionally or choose to convert, as long as rights are not tampered with, then there is no trigger for taxation or whatever. Yes, yeah. But if they choose not to do anything, it's okay, but should they want to cross the river and they cross something, then something will happen to them. I think that is the other thing which I wanted to convey to the Honourable Member.
I move to the last one on page 19, Madam Chair, the new clause. This is the whole symbol issue. Banks telling us that for these simple dispensation, it will be a very, very costly exercise. Huge figures were mentioned, saying that that would be the cost of the electronic implementation of these symbols. For the sake of fairness, we find these in section 11. This is of the Act. Section 11, A, 2 and 3, on page 48 of the Act, of the new Act. I'm sorry, it's section 11, 1, A, yes, 2 and 3. It's at the bottom of page 46. Those funny little things that we see there, those symbols. Now, needless to say, if the commencement section of the Principal Act would remain as it is, it would have the effect of Section 11 coming into operation on the date specified in the Presidential Proclamation for commencement of this Act. So the banks would then be obliged to follow suit immediately from the commencement of the Act. This may be slightly a funny way of doing it, but we respectfully propose that it might be the best way of doing it. Is to go straight to the commencement section in the Principal Act, which is the very last section of the Act. It is on page 342 of the Act, right at the bottom. And we propose the following in respect of that commencement section. This Act is called the Companies Act, and we insert subject to subsection 2 comes into operation on the date fixed by the President by proclamation in the Gazette. There's also a proposed deletion of those words in bold there between the square brackets, because that no longer applies. Time has already elapsed, the provision that we're having there, so it's proposed that it be deleted. It has become obsolete in any event. But there it is, subsection 2, section 11, 1A, 2 and 3, those symbols shall come, and this is important, Madam Chair, that we properly reflect on the effect of this, shall come into operation 3 years from the date of commencement of this Act. So the coming into operation of the symbol system is not, if the committee would go this route, is not being left open-ended. Parliament would then say that those symbols, the symbol dispensation, will commence, will take operation 3 years from the commencement of the principal act. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Was there something else?
Thanks. There is something which is not captured in the bill, in the proposal, and there is on reportable irregularities. Reportable irregularities. This matter has been discussed extensively to say that when the auditors find that something is irregular, they report say to the regulatory board, IRBA, Independent Regulatory Board of Auditors, and then now we are introducing the independent reviewer. What about if they find something that is irregular? Why can't they report it to one of the authority? And then it was said that we considered to say, what about reporting it to the commission? And the commission say it will notify also the relevant authority. So it is not captured in the proposal, and then we are saying maybe, but another school of thought says it may be done through regulations, in the regulations, but we are saying we are putting everything on the table here for the committee to consider when they, yeah, thanks.
Chair, if we can just sum up. Chair, I think obviously on our side, we again want to apologize that the document was not circulated earlier yesterday, because we intended to circulate it by 2 o'clock so that you would have it. We apologize profusely for that. I think there was a miscommunication, so we didn't circulate it. But I think the one thing that we just appreciate is for the committee to give us this opportunity to bring the proposals on the table. And in our view, the proposals that we've put on the table are proposals that really address the main issues that have been raised. And we think that the issues that have been raised are significant, and we think that through this process, obviously, you'll see that obviously the committee would have more information than it had before, and we think that the committee would have even more options when it deliberates, and we hope that our contribution will assist the committee in doing that. But there are just 3 areas that I want to emphasize just for clarity. I think I'll go back to our document. I think it's page 10 of it. Page 10 of the document here, the clause 43. I think we have indicated there that our proposal is a deletion of that section, subsection 12. But I think if you look at the new insertion there, there is something that says that a person who becomes ineligible or disqualified while serving as a director of a company ceases to be, and then there's words that are added there, entitled to become whatever. We think that that insertion, we would like to take it back. We would like to leave it as it is and just deal with the deletion, proposing the deletion of subsection 12, because upon just discussion earlier today, we find that that part entitled to might just be opened up to a lot of interpretation as unnecessary. I think it's clear enough that says that the person is precluded from acting as a director. Yes. So I think if there is a way they can be read to say precluded, that's our proposal, that it should be precluded, you know. I just felt that if we leave it and you read our document without this explanation, you may be inclined to think that this is the thinking that we have. And then in terms of the area around the audit, Chair, I think we have indicated in the area that talks about where another legislation requires an audit. And McDonald did indicate the complexities around some of the legislation, like the Cooperatives Act. We're talking about it because it's our act, so we can always, you know, we won't offend anybody. So we're also saying that in as much as other laws can require audits to be done, it should not just be a free-for-all, because that will undermine the very same purpose of actually relieving the companies from audits. But we're saying that there are instances, like for instance in the financial services space, where the regulatory environment might actually require audits. And we're saying this act must not frustrate that part. It must allow that so that there's coexistence. But it must not be that any other legislation that is done everywhere else that is not under a regulated environment that can actually require some companies that should actually be exempted to then still do the audits. So I think that tension should be minimized. We would not want to have that. I think we just want to emphasize that for the committee, that we are not saying that any law should actually go against this one. And then the other aspect, Chair, is the proposal that we made around the business practitioner process, where we think that the business practitioner must notify the relevant regulatory authority. I think if we put it into context, is that if, for instance, a company that's under rescue falls under the regulation, for instance, by the FSB, the FSB might not even know that there's a rescue. They deal with a whole lot of companies. And we are wanting a situation where a business rescue process would also have the support of the regulators that are regulating the companies. But for them to give that support, they must know about it. So it's really introducing that notification process so that if it's a company that is regulated in a particular sector, then we must notify the sector that is relevant, just so that there's cooperation. But at the same time, also the regulators, where they would like to take action, they need to then be in a position to recognize that there's a rescue process so that they can assess whether it's even necessary to take that action at that point or where they can wait until they take it after the rescue process has been completed. So I think we're trying to harmonize that in that area. And the last part, Chair, that I also just want to emphasize is the issue around the power shares. I mean, we're saying here, we're including the word and we're proposing that word of optional conversion so that there is no confusion that there is a forced conversion. However, we also want the process where the regulations will facilitate and encourage people to actually convert. Because if you're moving from a different dispensation to a new one, you actually would like ultimately people to move over, but without forcing them. I think for us, it is important for the enforcement and the implementation of this legislation that we're dealing with one dispensation. But it's something that we anticipate that gradually we'll be moving into that without forcing conversion. And like we said, it was never the intention to force conversion. So those are the things that I just wanted to add, and I just want to say again, thanks for the opportunity. I think, yes, we've worked very hard, and the team has been working very hard on this on this process, and thank you very much for the time.
Now, DG Dodwen, truly, we certainly appreciate that it's turned out to be quite complex, the whole operation, but you've really brought a team that has applied itself. Thank you very much. There may, of course, still be, at this stage, we just go over to the committee. Any comments briefly? Of course, it's questions, really, that I'm interested in, and any further clarification in this regard from what we have recently heard. Kotsi? Honourable Smala? Who else is there? That's two. Honourable Harris. Thank you. See, there's something wrong with that mic.
Yeah. Thank you, Chair. Chair, I just want first to thank the department. You know, going through this document is clearly an indication that they have taken into consideration almost all the issues raised by the stakeholders. I was not really expecting that they would go this far, but I must thank them for the work they have done. It is just unfortunate that we saw the document this morning, and I'm happy that the deputy DG is saying they've also identified something that they want to go back and check. And that gives us an opportunity as well to look at those issues that we think perhaps we might have more time to check them or to consult on them. But in general, there are issues I was really looking very closely to them to see what, I mean, I even the one about the banks that they have even gone into extending the time. So I'm just commenting, you know, positively about how they have dealt with this, and perhaps they would accept one or two methods that would come with even afterwards that we would identify after this. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, and we just move on. Yes, that was one of the
Thank you, Chair. To refer to clause 40.40 on page 9, applicant referred to maybe to put the word exhaustive, you know, on, you know, at the end of some of the sub-paragraphs. But my understanding was then why not limit A2K and put it all in one or two paragraphs and say that anything that has got a financial implication towards shareholders or the company, that has got to go through a special resolution, and then you should maybe then cover all A2K. Why would you like to open a can of worms in that? Maybe if you want to bring one something that brings out something, why not then take them all out and then put that one section in? To stop with that one. The one that I want to talk to that's very close to is subsection 136.2. I'm just trying to find the clause. It was your clause 83, sorry, on page 13. Subsection 132. When the duration of business rescue proceedings talks to with the resolutions of the court, when that actually starts, or when that actually affects. But subsection 2 then further talks only to that says a practitioner may cancel or suspend or partially or condensely. It actually doesn't refer to the actual court that actually comes with that actual ruling, and if the department actually also tried to refresh their minds, it was also a huge concern of the financial sector that a practitioner can just cancel that contract without a court ruling, and which has got some other economic implications in the country. And I would want to see or try to understand why the word court wasn't being brought into subsection 2 there. Chair, I'm going to give other members a call, so I might have a snap, another bite at it. I'm just looking for something else.
Honourable Harris, followed by Honourable Salah.
Thanks very much, Chairperson, and Rivindo, and you. As said, I also believe that this is a good work done by the department. I want to just draw the department to clause 105 of the amendment, insofar as it refers to section 194.2b. It refers to of the principal act. Where it says, actually the act says the person may not be appointed for the second term. And what the clause says is that the person may be appointed for the second term. That is the amendment. Now the question is it that because the act says may not be appointed for the second term, that we are now saying can be appointed for the second term? It gives me two meanings. One meaning may be that this means that the maximum period for which the chairperson and members of the tribunal can serve is 2 terms. The other meaning can be that this is the removal of the restriction to one term, but does not necessarily refer to that two terms only. It might as well mean that beyond the two terms, that person may be appointed. I seek clarity around that theory.
Thank you, Honourable Hatt.
Chair, Clause 43, the disqualified director. I appreciate the amendment to the proposed, but I still have yet to be convinced by the department that clause or subsection 9A in the original act needs to be there. It's, to my mind, it's a substantial change from the 1973 act, a substantial addition, in that it severely limits the time period for disqualification. And I'm not sure there's been any cases or examples that have happened in South Africa that justify limiting that time period. So I'd appreciate an explanation there. Then in clause 83.
You were referring to the principal act. Clause
9. Well, section 69, subsection 9A. And then clause 83 on page 13 of DTI's document, the amendment of section 136. I just want to check the addition there of the agreement to which section 35A and B of the Insolvency Act apply. Don't have the Insolvency Act. Can you just run through, does that act cover all of the concerns that the stakeholders had? And if there are any that were brought up in the hearings that aren't covered by the two clauses of the Insolvency Act, can you let us know? I still, although we've discussed it for a long time, Chair, on page 17, the amendment for clause 113, I still don't really understand the purpose of section 218. I understand that it contradicts section 78(2) directly, but surely one way of resolving that is simply by not having section 218 of the Principal Act. I don't really see the benefit that it brings. And then lastly, Chair, the last page of the document, which is when the Act comes into effect. Two small questions there. The first is this idea that we suspend the symbols and the names for 3 years. It implies that the DTI is sensitive to the cost of converting the system, but would like the bank to rather be able to spend that over a three-year period instead of all at once. But my hearing of it was that the banks were coming here and saying we don't think it's good value for money spending 100 million rand each. I read the minutes of the last meeting and I gather the costing issue was discussed, but if you could just recap for me because I wasn't there. The more fundamental issue of incurring a 100 million rand cost per bank is, I think, the one at stake rather than perhaps giving them more time to pay that money. And then lastly, obviously that clause deals with when the act must be implemented. I would just appreciate one last reassurance from the DTI that the Companies Commission will be ready, that all of the systems will be in place, and we will be able to enforce and police this act properly on the date that you envision. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. Just a point that has been made to me now is just to clarify, perhaps it's also referring to the DTI's document on the 25th of January, like a PowerPoint type in the responses and so on. Do you remember the first part of this process? On slide 7, where the point was made about the audit and subsidiary of foreign public companies, that particular issue. And if you look within the Act, the Principal Act now, under section 31 and section 30, and 2 of the Stealthy Act, Principal Act, were you not considering the inclusion of foreign companies there or not? What is your view there, having already responded earlier in a particular manner in this regard? If you could just go over that. Thank you. Members should also be cognizant of the fact that we did request Hansard for all of the meetings. Now, these were issued yesterday or the day before. I'm not sure if everyone has them, but they were in the mailboxes. I'm looking at everyone. And Hansard will be a blow-by-blow account of all the proceedings that took place on those days. Right, we'll hand over immediately to DTI. And the DDG and her team.
Thanks for the questions from honourable members. Again, the team will deal with it, but I just want to say that we will also just check some of the things that are not here. There are some things that we've agreed that we'll make proposals on, like the reportable irregularities, and we did realise that it's omitted from this document. So I think one of the issues that we just raised right now is perhaps one of those. So where we have omitted, we'll go back. But I think where we agreed that we'll make proposals, we'll still provide proposals if they have been omitted. I'll hand over to you guys to just respond to the issues quickly.
Thanks, Chair and Honourable Members. From my side, I will comment in the context of saying we are coming with proposals, and then there are issues which are being raised to say, why can't you consider 1, 2, 3? And then we are saying, let's marry the two, and the two proposals go into one direction. That is the context where I will, how I should respond to these issues. The issue which I want to deal with is the issue of 5-year period. I think whether the 10-year period or it was limitless in 1973 and 5 years, the DDG said she can articulate very well on that. But I think as for now, we are just saying if there was no time limit, and then we put the time limit, and a person is given a right to approach a court at any time, the court has got an inherent jurisdiction to say yes, we agree or we don't within that 5-year period. And then that is our proposal to say, can't we treat it like that? 218, I think Johan will deal with that, but again, let's read it as a proposal. Whether to drop it or not is another issue. The committee has got the power to do that, but we thought maybe we are moving to a situation where we are reconciling contradictory issues or difficult issues. And then the issue of the commission, the issue of suspending for 3 years, the cost part of it. Yes, we promise that we are conferring with our counterpart, the British. And then maybe the service delivery issue. We have not yet got any response. We profusely apologize for that. But all in all, we are saying this seems to be a small, impediment along the way, and then it can be suspended without impacting on the operation of the whole act. Because there are certain sections which, if you suspend one, then there is a trigger for unintended consequences. So we are saying, this one, why can't we suspend it? And we do a thorough audit. But previously we said, compliance by nature has got cost. But let's look at the totality of issues. What is it that we want to do as a country? And we said these are progressive provisions.
which other countries, in particular the US states, as well as the British, they are moving in that direction, and this is a progressive one. But because costs which were not well computed, the banks didn't show us computation, how they arrived to that cost, then we agreed and said, yes, we can give them that latitude to do that, but without deleting this progressive issue which we want as a nation. Go and do that. If it convinces us and the like, is okay. But compliance by nature, if it is good, it may come with some added cost. That is the fact of life. My colleagues will also deal with other issues. That issue of two terms only is beyond my comprehension, but Johan and the DDG said they appreciate it very well. They will articulate on that. Thanks.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If I may refer to the clause 105, it relates to section 194 in the Act. Section 194 is on page 320. There it is, 194, the heading Appointment of Companies Tribunal. Now, we did indicate that the problem is here, that there's provision for these ministerial appointments, but it doesn't say anything about the term of office. The section is simply silent on the term of office. So the proposal is that the chairperson and each member of the tribunal would serve for terms of 5 years. And I think this is maybe where the issue has arisen, subject to subsection 2B. Now, if we read in the Act subsection 2B, and that is already, it's already there, a person may not be reappointed to a second term as chairperson of the tribunal. So clearly the policy consideration here was that even though members should be eligible for serving second terms, the chairperson should not be eligible for serving a second term. So if this proposal would be accepted, it would have the effect of any member of the tribunal save or except the chairperson will be eligible for reappointment to a second term. Not beyond that, to a second term. So each member might serve for 10 years, but because of this exclusion existing in subsection 2, the chairperson, the minister would only be able to or entitled to appoint a chairperson for a period of 5 years only, and that person would not be eligible for a second term. I hope, Madam Chair, that I've been fair in addressing that. On the issue that was raised by,
I don't know whether I'm understanding this thing well. I think that subsection refers to the person not being elected for the second term as a chairperson, but they say he's appointed as a member, ordinary member. He can, even if they say the person is a chairperson in his term, in the following term, he can be an ordinary member without being a chairperson.
I'm sorry, Madam Chair, we haven't been fair. No, that is absolutely okay. The exclusion is only in respect of serving the second term as a chairman. But what you are envisaging, sir, would be perfectly feasible. Yeah. Madam Chair, if I can then turn to, I think it was the Honourable Mr. Harris that raised, I can also recall from being in a meeting earlier on, Section 69, 9A. It's on page 136 of the Act. It says, it relates to the 5-year period with respect to the Madam Chair, the 5-year is can easily create confusion because we focus on the 5, but the terms can go well beyond 5 years. A disqualification in terms of subsection 8, those are those dishonesty ones and impairing integrity, ends at the later of 5 years, and now this is important, after the date of removal from office, and see what happens with the next, or the completion of the sentence imposed for the relevant offence. So just for the sake of the example, a very unfortunate person is convicted of fraud and sentenced to 10 years imprisonment, served 7 years before being released on parole, so having effectively served 7 years of imprisonment, only then does the 5 years kick in. So that person would be ineligible for serving as a director of any company, not for a period of 5 years, but for a period of 12 years. Because the 5 years only kicks in after completion of sentence. Needless to say, if it was for removal from office, then it kicks in the 5 years immediately after having been removed from office. I'm not saying that entirely addresses what you have in mind, but I just wanted to reflect on the 5 years. It can be actually a little bit confusing because it can go well beyond that. If I can maybe also raise the other issue that was raised by the Honourable Mr. Harris on 218. I, for one, Mr. Harris, would not mind section 218 going somewhere else because I've read it many times, but be that as it may, I think if you are suggesting that, why should the committee not maybe consider to remove section 218 sub 1 in its entirety? The immediate effect would then be that wherever something in this, for instance an agreement, is declared void in terms of this act, there would be no provision for a court of law to make an order to that effect. Because the part that is really operative here is that portion that says, unless a court, right at the end of subsection 1, unless a court declares that agreement, resolution or provision to be void. So if we delete subsection 1 in its entirety, merely through the operation of law of a provision in this act, would, for instance, certain agreements be void as in immediately, without having to approach a court of law to declare so. I think what I can say here is that we must just be guided in discussing this by the principle of, if it's deleted in its entirety, would we not create a situation where there might be prejudice in certain instances for interested parties or stakeholders if this unless part that directs us to the court of law is not part of the act? I was wondering if one of my... Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In response to the Honourable Smaller, regarding the issue about the court application as regards business rescue and the practitioner's rights therein, is quite right in the sense that when we dealt with the original amendments in the bill and the financial sector and their worries, it was in response to the cancellation of a contract where a court order will be required. The particular section that is now found in our proposals is in regard to amendments being made to the suspension clauses of contracts. So there is not an application made to court in that regard in some of the particular section. Suspension requires practitioners' rights, when you want to cancel, as you will see from the previous section, as per section 136, then it requires a cancellation order as per court application therein. In regard to the other section, as in clause 40, section 65, this is something of a debate that we also having amongst ourselves in regards to the issue about an exhaustive list when dealing with special resolutions and the addition of an exhaustive list. One must bear in mind that the list is simply one of the ease of reference. It is not a list of rights. It doesn't give anybody sort of rights. It's just a list for a person to have an ease of reference to say that in these particular circumstances, a special resolution is required. But we're also looking at a proposal to maybe have a catch-all to say that the list is not exhaustive. There might be other areas requiring special resolutions therein, and therefore we might look at a proposal of including that as part of the amendment as proposed as well.
Covered it, or is there something else?
Chair, I think there's still one issue that hasn't been covered, and that's the reference to section 35A and 35B contracts that are protected in the business rescue situation. The commentators didn't all agree, put it that way, to have the section 35A and 35B type of contract that you find under liquidation situations, sequestration situations, be included. But their comment was that the provision of Section 35A and 35B of the Insolvency Act does not automatically apply under business rescue situations, and that the wording that we use in the Act should be changed to basically make those provisions applicable to the business rescue situation. That is why the wording had to be changed to contracts referred to in Section 35A and B as if they had been applicable to the situation. So it's actually making them applicable to business rescue situations that the commentators ask us to change this. Just a last remark maybe on the list of special resolutions. In clause 40, it's basic. It's not a substantive provision in the Act. I think one must be clear about that. It's a summary of all the places, or a reference place, a reference to all the places in the Act where special resolutions are required in a substantive other provision of the Act. So it's actually a list or a summary, and that's why it wouldn't. If you take it away, it won't change the Act as well. It's a very big convenience to have it there. Then you actually have a place to go and look where the special resolutions are situated elsewhere in the Act. Thanks.
Chair, I don't know if any other member wanted to add anything, but I think just from what they've said, they've covered extensively the questions. But Chair, I just forgot to introduce and acknowledge one of our members that came a bit late, Advocate Nyateli there. I'm just feeling that he may not be speaking now because he's afraid he's not being introduced. So I'm just doing that. But having listened to the colleagues here, just to pick on that, I think from a legislative drafting point of view, Chair, I think it's proper for us to also just advise, obviously, the committee to say that list of special resolutions, I think it serves as a proper way of drafting, because if there's something that you know already in the Act and you are able to sum it up, it makes life easier for the court as well when they interpret and all of that. So I think we'll propose that it remains in that way in terms of the drafting style so that we capture all of these issues. But Chair, I think that for the purpose of Honourable Harris, because he wasn't here when we did our responses on this, in regards to the disqualification of directors, I think Johannes has clarified the 5-year period when it commences and all of that. But I think the main issue that we would like the committee to also consider is the fact that the 1973 Act was before the constitution of this country. And if you look at the constitution and the guidance that is given there, I think honorable member can be referred to section 47 of the constitution, which deals with the appointment of members to the National Assembly, for instance. It is very clear there that the guidance that we're getting as well for the legislation is that we need to align with our constitution. Our constitution clearly puts the 5-year period. And I think for any legislation that comes after the constitution, it always has to align itself to that. So that is another consideration that was taken in the drafting process, even when this bill was brought to this committee in 2008. So we just want to just emphasize that part, that there is coexistence. And however, if there is a strong feeling that a particular member of a society should not be allowed, even after having served their conviction, their sentence, and even after that, before the expiry of that 5-year period, any person can approach the court and say that this person is still not in the position to act as a director. The period must be extended, so the court can still do that. So that is not removed from the provisions. I think we just wanted to make that clear. And then the last part, Chair, that I just want to talk to is the part around the readiness of the Companies Commission. We've said it the last time when we were here. We are on track. And as of the 1st of April, if this act has got to be operationalized, we will be ready to operationalize it. And in regards to the issue around the readiness of the business to comply with the provision Section 11 that deals with symbols, we're saying that as much as we are not convinced because we've not seen the figures, but we're saying that in the interest of considering the cost for those companies, it's proper to allow some time for them to raise themselves so that it is done properly. And we still believe that those clauses are very progressive and that that's where the world is going, and that it will also do a great deal of benefit for our intellectual property regime as well, because we want our companies to operate with ease. The technology is advancing and we want to advance with the technology. So we believe that we still need to have that. Chair, those are the things that we wanted to deal with. And then, Chair, the issue that you asked about the subsidiaries of foreign companies, the easy answer that we can give to that is that if you are a subsidiary of a foreign company, but you are incorporated here in South Africa, you are a South African company, so this act applies to you. So if there are issues of audit, you will be required to audit. However, in our responses, we did indicate that to the extent that there may be confusion, we will propose a provision to just clarify so that it's not missed, especially seeing that it has been raised before. So it is an omission on our part that we didn't include it. But in fact, legally speaking, we think that there is nothing that needed to be clarified in the legislation, because we've gone back to it and we looked at the legislation. And if you are a subsidiary, you are incorporated in South Africa. The fact that you are a subsidiary of a foreign company actually does not really make you different from a South African company, because you've been incorporated here. So thank you very much for the time again to respond to the questions.
No, we appreciate it. I know that we're going to continue with our deliberations. Of course, we have a program in place. And I had earlier asked if Ms. Herling could have had this opportunity, because you indicated yourself to us that you haven't had an opportunity to even have this with your team. But we may be able to look at that a little differently, as it were, to see how that can be brought in to the equation. Because what we're looking at this particular time is a situation where, yes, we can go on till half past and so on, because there's no debate this afternoon. However, I'm not even sure if the room is booked, you know, and we book until 1. As I think you know, that is the time that we book for. So, before moving on into that section, because I really want to release the certain members of the department, should they so, if that was needed, because we did mention the time. So, a sincere thank you to yourself, DDG, Ms. Zodwen Thule, for being here with your team. I think I've said that already. There are a number of questions which perhaps still remain
as people go through the rest of the documents. So I know that you will always send someone to be with us during our deliberations. Am I correct in understanding that? And so there is always that time to re-engage. I just wanted to do, you had, as you said, an oversight earlier on. I didn't see until recently that Treasury was here, had sent someone from Treasury. And that I think we appreciated you being here because a number of the issues were also, you know, I know that DTI indicated they had also had consultations with yourself when they were addressing certain matters and responding to them. So we do appreciate your attendance here with us. Honourable Harris?
Yes, if I may, I just have a very small follow-up relating to a question I originally asked on the 25th of January to the department.
I was going to suggest that we move on to the next leg because they're going to come back. They're going to have to come back on a few other things. We've got 3 pages of material here, which we can't hope to engage with. We can't. Because it's going to take a half an hour or 15 minutes minimum. In Manco, it took half an hour to go through. And then for us to engage, it's going to take another half an hour, you see. And then the department will want further clarifications on the issue. So I don't see it taking less than 2 o'clock, you see. And that is why I actually indicated to the DDG, I know that they've also always tried to avail themselves when essential. And we would certainly hope that this will be possible with outstanding issues that have already arisen prior to the 3 pages that have now come up. But we would like to release you because we do have other issues that we have to address before I close the meeting and everyone disappears. So thank you very much once again. Honourable Harris, I'm going to certainly get that from you so that it can be forwarded to DTI in writing, as will, I think, a number of other issues be forwarded, because I'm quite certain we didn't exhaust our questioning in this regard. And I think I have, you know, I accept that because you got the document this morning, as I did. But that was not simply the department, it was also possibly a communication within our own administration. Now, I have got some very important changes before anyone decides to leave early to another commitment. We have had certain issues have come up in Parliament regarding the programming that was laid down. Some of it related directly to the NCOP, we have been reassured that the time that they require will be able to be factored in, notwithstanding certain construction that is taking place in their chamber, as you know, some of you. I was unaware of that. They will be making other, as it were, house or chamber arrangements. But because of that, it did seem we've got a lot of legislation to get through before the 30th of March. We did not want to limit this to a 20-minute debate. Otherwise, we can have this in 3 weeks' time or 2 weeks. Not a problem. But that, I don't think, was this is a very important piece of legislation, and we should not try to reduce it to a 20-minute debate. We also would like the minister then to be there. And with that in mind, and also taking into account that the NCOP would require 3 days, I understand, from the committee secretary. Well, yes, Honourable Khadebe. I think we just wanted to put in the third day, didn't we, just to the fallback. You know, quorums and all kinds of issues. But not that we're planning for the worst, but simply a contingency factor. So if we keep that in mind, and also the acknowledgement from the minister now that the 15th is possible, it would still require the programming whip to directly agree, if I'm not mistaken. But with the negotiating skills of our whip, I have no doubt that that will be achieved. I have already alerted her to the problem informally. So if you go back, you will see very quickly that there was a formal consideration on the 15th. And that would simply have to go by the board. We can't do a formal consideration on the 14th. You need, because that would be a Monday anyway. So you'd need to go back to Friday. And Friday would be about the 10th, is it? No, the 11th of March. I hope I'm correct there. Because the 9th is a Wednesday. The reason you would need to totally conclude on that is because administration, you've got several amendments needs to look at it. There may even be challenges in terms of the printing of certain issues. So if you come back to the 11th being the Friday and the 10th being Thursday, we may need to look at somehow trying to look at, to review the strategic plan and take it further on. So we are needing to shift the strategic plan. The minister has agreed that that can wait for him as well, and you'll try and work on that possibly on the date that the bid debate was scheduled. You probably would have been here anyway. And we then do the formal consideration on the 9th. If something goes wrong, because I am not going to have only the overhead with a laptop, I want a printed document here, because there are too many amendments that will be made, and you will want to look at it with your parties as well. Do you follow? So as we come to the closure, we all want printed documentation. That means you need to be almost there by the 8th. I have proposed to bring in the 8th as a committee day, a full committee day, and the programming whip has said, if legislation is involved, it overtakes other decisions which allocate certain days to committees. So I have to come to you with that, because you may have already made arrangements, and I'm looking at yourself, Honourable Harris, and hoping you've got your diary with you. I know that the Honourable Smalley may have allowed some time there, because at one stage that had been a task team meeting day. So it was yourself, it was the IFP, in this case yourself, Ariani Ambrosini, Honourable Ariani Ambrosini. I'm not sure if between you and Honourable Labenia you can work it out. Honourable Kotze from Pope as well. And of course, we simply mentioned these names as regulars recently in the committee company legislation. We require a completed decision. In other words, you're not on oversight, because we do need to proceed on a quorum basis now and get the bill, if possible, if everyone agrees that is a committee, then we need to put in an adoption day, a possible adoption day of, what did I say, the 11th? On the 9th. On the 9th. Mm-hmm. All right. So, if you can accept the proposal, which management can, and by management I'm talking of the presiding officers of Parliament, of the 8th Tuesday, and make that a committee day, it's going to give us the day we require. Honourable Ambrosini, I'm now going to simply take responses on that for input. Honourable Ambrosini.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I don't expect this committee to adjust its schedule to my need or aspirations. Nonetheless, I will put them forward, perhaps to be considered marginally. First of all, I've not been here, but I've followed, so I've been here in spirit, even though I'm recorded on some of the things to be here physically. And it seems to me that this process has moved by listening to the public input, giving the department an opportunity to reply, as all legislation does. But this doesn't eliminate the need for all of us to discuss these issues and to a party input mandated positions. It might be easier for the ANC to do it internally than for us, and some for us, than for the rest of us. So my plea is, let's not get stuck with an adoption date. There are lots of real issues which have not been settled and should not be settled exclusively in the interaction between the public input, or those who provide public input on the department. That's the first thing. The second thing is that I, and this is me personally, apologize for speaking about me, I'm dealing with a number of bills, and I'm in this protection of information bill, which has been coinciding, and the programming committee has been made to coincide with this. So my personal plea would be if we could have a session which don't meet with the personal information bill, and I'm available. I think that there is value if we meet also extensively in a workshop environment for 2 or 3 days dealing with this, with matters of this nature. And I will not be available on the 9th of March because I'm in court in my litigation against the Speaker to restore the right of members of Parliament to introduce legislation.
I should just, you're speaking though as an alternative for Honourable Mabenya, am I not correct?
Actually, I'm the principal now. I'm not sure whether it's been notified, but I'm the one who handles the legislation.
I only mention that because when I clarified the issue through the committee secretary with the ISP, they pointed that the full member will take the decisions, you see. Now, because I needed that with respect to alternate members throughout the committee. So I think it would be could be constructive for all of us to consult with our full members or whoever in a particular case a party has indicated is the head or leading a party. In this case, I know I have been informed by the DA that the Honourable Harris, I hope I'm still correct on that basis, speaks for the DA when it comes to some of the program type of issues. Is that correct, Honourable Harris? So it is you that I would then go through, per se. Yeah. All right. Now, the only one then would be, I can't see, but I did know she was here. It's Honourable Cotsey. I know she's here. Oh, right. Oh, yes, sir. All right. So what we'll do is we'll send this through. I need you to know that the whip does need a signature. And then the chair of chairs needs to put a signature on it, you know, from that final processing, as it were, which puts everything together in this regard. So we'll have that by Friday or Thursday. What is today? Today is the Wednesday. We'll have it, I'm sure, by Thursday. Okay. What you must accept is that the 18th, which you were going to be here anyway for, briefing by the minister on SONA, etc., etc. Do you remember that one? That is also an option to utilize if time begins to be constrained. Okay. So I still have to discuss that, though I was not able to discuss it with our whip, who was ill yesterday, so I'll still need to discuss that. I don't want to waste time on the program, But I now, with the secretary and I discussed this in the secretariat meeting, that it's going to be useful if members do what they've done in some other pieces of legislation, and that is come to us with questions that they would still like responded to. What that will achieve is what Ms. Herling has already done on three pages. You raise a particular issue, which we've done with public input, not from members. I'm sure you're aware from public hearings and also from Manker. So if you can come forward, they will have that opportunity to study those two documents, the one from the members, and also that will not cap your inquiry. I hope I'm quite, I'm understood now. It won't mean because you asked two questions today that you're not going to be asking anything else the following day and so on and so forth. I would also appeal to members, one of our consultants here, Mr. Pammer, it was from him that this issue on the foreign companies came in. And I don't know if all of you study the documents that we were given by VTI with the responses. You know, you need to look at this to see what they've actually proposed now and see whether or not something has been overlooked. All right, so I gather that may have been the case. One of your questions, which you asked, as you said, on the 25th, is still not addressed. And if you could just indicate that clearly. Right, so we've dealt with that and that. I would like members to try and bring the Act as well as the all of these documents, you know, the earlier responses as well as the, and actually as a matter of fact, this is not mine, I think it's Mr. Pammer's, is that right? As well as the amendment bill, as well as the responses, as well as the Hansard, should they so require it, and of course the responses today. Now, the only issue I would like to ask is, do you want to rather study the input by Ms. Herling that she has made, and we deal with this on Friday? Because you've just received it. Or do you have 10 minutes for her to highlight key areas that you ought to, I wouldn't say that you ought to focus on, but that she considers important. Would you, can we do that for 7 minutes or so? Yes, Honourable Hadebe.
I think because it's her input, she must lead us. So that's
yeah,
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 so I concur with that.
All right. So I'll understand as people lead, and we will find, give this in the Hansard. We are getting a transcript of this meeting as well. Ms. Herling.
The focus on this three pager was mainly looking at the written submission that DTI presented to us on the 28th of January in relation to the summary of the 3rd of February that I've done for the committee. So there are the gaps related mainly to the amendment bill. There are a few overlaps to the Act where there's a clause in the bill but not necessarily the specific subsection being addressed. The key issues, which we might definitely need clarification from the department, would be on item number 6, which is clause 19, that reported that they will be looking at the mechanism for reportable irregularities. There was also an issue related to a reference to future directives in section 30, clause subsection 6, E, F, and G. And then item 7, clause 24, there's an issue there in terms of the Act allows that 60 days after additional fees than was authorized, the board is allowed to actually authorize them retroactively, and whether or not this would open up minority members to prejudice. I think it's my computer. In item number 8, one of the submissions, a definitive directive is introduced into clause 45A, which focuses on a directive for this, for that particular section. And then they were requesting that we actually include the same directive definition, just repeating it in other sections, such as, I think, section 69. Item number 9, clause 67G, the new amendment bill allows, it gives a specific time period within which you need to give an application to the court where a transaction has been disputed, which relates to the disposal of assets, mergers or amalgamations. The issue being raised in the submission is not about the 10-day period, it's rather about how long it takes the court to actually deal with such applications, and about whether or not that application or that transaction will still be valid after the time period which the court takes to resolve it. Item number 10, clause 77A. We've spoken quite extensively about commercial versus technical insolvency relating to reckless trading. This just brings it to financial distress companies and focusing on the definition for that, including insolvency, but not clarifying whether it's commercial or technical, which may need to just be considered by the committee. And then item number 11. Okay, item number 11 is clause 83.6. A couple of the submissions raised issues where, to a certain extent, the DTI has now included section 35A and section 35B of the Insolvency Act, but it focuses on the business rescue practitioner's powers. They're requesting that that gets continued to during the court process. And then the other additional issues, they're not directly covered in the amendment bill, but they were raised during the submissions. Section 21A2 is potentially it could affect how the country as a whole, how our cultures operate, but they're asking that it be changed from currently it's 2 degrees of natural adopted relations to 1 degree. Then the item number 2B is an extension. They're focusing on the IFRS, the International Financial Reporting Standards. They do not allow you to incorporate goodwill into your finance, which may be an issue in certain companies. So you wouldn't be able to consider the fair value of goodwill as an asset when you are doing your solvency test. And then a concern was raised by business partners, item number 3, section 15.7. Basically, the concern was that companies are now being forced to change, to align themselves to the new act, to the memorandum of incorporation and the shareholder agreement, and whether or not small and medium enterprises would be able to cover the cost and have the capacity to do that within 2 years. Then item number 4, the concern here is that the memorandum of incorporation would allow directors to do certain issues in alignment with the Act. But if the memorandum of incorporation doesn't allow specific action which the director takes anyway, the board is allowed to approve it after the fact. And this could actually prejudice certain of the shareholders, or potentially also allow the director to do something possibly harmful for the company. item number 5, section 27. This is a consideration, the act is allowing you to change your financial year end up to 15 months after the current financial year end. And there's a concern about it coinciding with your annual general meeting, and also were you legally obligated to change it to potential 18 months, you would have to take 2 years to actually get to the proper date. Or you'd have to cut your year in under 12 months and then report again on the 12-month period. Item number 8, guidance was just asked in terms of a stipulation about adequate considerations for the issuing of shares, which the board has to provide. Item number 10, section 62.3bi, the forced inclusion of summarized form of financial statements within the notices of annual general meetings, which is a recommendation or a request that we give the option of either putting the full financial statement or the summarized version into the notice. Item number 11, section 64.9. There's a concern from doing the anchor was expressed about firstly finding out what the current practices are in terms of adopting decisions or making decisions. Here it allows that if only one shareholder with voting rights is present at a meeting, at least one of them, but there's a quorum, you'd be able to make the decision a whole meeting. So the issue was raised about it possibly having a negative impact on minority holders. Item number 12, section 66.8 and D. There was a request that we consider splitting remuneration in relation to executive and non-executive directors, because executive directors would already have, as part of the package, have this included. Item number 13, section 72.4, the deference of requirements to implement a social and ethics committee until 2012. The Law Society has just raised an issue about having it similar to what the new Act would allow for a 2-year grace period after the implementation of the Act to just continue that for this bill. Then item number 14, section 83B2. The clause is considered to, or the section is considered to be problematic for companies specifically who do not have audits every year, and whether or not an auditor or someone in that capacity could just step into the company and actually be able to determine whether or not the company has debt or has no debt, sorry. Item number 15. The SSB has raised an issue about one of the statutory functions that are that they have to approve amalgamations and mergers within the financial services industry, and they are concerned that the current Act would impact on this. Item number 16, section 135.1A. It speaks of post-commencement finance. Business partners raised an issue about whether or not we could be having an unintended consequence on small businesses or companies who are busy or under business rescue, as with that there could be risk in terms of financing and getting additional funding, as they probably wouldn't have much collateral security left, and whether or not other companies or lenders would actually be willing to give them money. Item number 17, section 118.1 CI. There's a test in relation to effective transactions offers around mergers and amalgamations, and whether we should consider having, considering the number of shareholders when you're dealing with a private company. Item number 18, section 128. The key issue here is how long it takes in court in terms of the business issue cases may not be considered to be the most important cases. And then also you'd need quite extensive commercial experience to actually judge a case. So this, these might actually be constraints in carrying out this function. And then item number 19, section 131.482. The main concern here is one of the considerations when determining whether a company should be under business rescue would be whether or not they fail to pay over any amounts related to employment matters and whether this should rather be deleted, as this may not be the main reason for such a business rescue proceeding. And then item number 20, 643, this was a suggestion made that the business rescue practitioner should be given a minimum monthly fee, so as to, especially for small businesses, so that you'd be able to pay the practitioner, but then once you've actually reached the stage of success and you were able to operate them by yourself, they would then be able to claim a bonus after rehabilitation. Item number 21, section 945.4b, there was a request that we consider including creditors that would otherwise be subordinated under liquidation, and they should have an appraisal of voting interests as well, and not just concurrent creditors. Item number 22 is something the committee should consider briefly, section 147.182, whether or not the practitioner should also have the option to reject claims which have been submitted to it. Item number 23, section 164, to defer the introduction of the shareholders' appraisal rights until after the 2-year moratorium for companies to amend the constitution to avoid inadvertently triggering these appraisal rights. And then item number 24, relating to section 185, the key concern was there, once again, whether CIPRO and then the Commission would be able to carry out these functions given current issues with CIPRO. Item number 25, section 282, the claim is that the section is too wide and it may actually lead to vexatious and unsubstantiated malicious claims, which would place have quite a possibly negative impact on small and medium enterprises in terms of having to fight legal battles.
Thank you. This is not really to explore, but I think I was informed by Ms. Hurley that as this comes from the submissions, for the most part, the evidence, the reference would also be found in the summaries which we got. But I thought one was just simply looking up the one made with respect to 131. We follow that thinking, because here it's referring to 1314, what page would that be on then, you see? No, because it's referring to also the summaries when we say Booster did X and KPMG Y, you know, and so on and so forth. Pardon? 68. Okay, so that is then made here, and we find out who Cronier was. Okay, so it would be useful, because some of this here, for example, the people who made the submissions to us were not, I'm just simply using this as an example, I haven't even studied it, would not have had the benefit of what we have recently had and the DTI's response. And neither would Ms. Hurley have had what was said today, for example. So certainly, it would appear as if, on the face of this, and I haven't even read it, the reference is to voidable transactions, etc., etc. They did deal quite a bit on the what would be voidable and what not be voidable. So it would also be useful for you to link what is said here in the summaries, in the issues raised by Ms. Hurling, to, of course, what we've also received today. Because what we've received today was not factored, and I'm sure you accept that. I think I should make that very clear. So what would be useful is for you to just apply your mind to this, not now, if possible, later on in the day and tomorrow, so that on Friday we may already have certain questions or areas we wanted to highlight for the department itself. And we may be able to even let them have that in advance. Yes, Honourable Ambrosini.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I'm not sure that this document is meant to drive our question to the department or our deliberation. It's an excellent summary. Thank you very, very much. There are a couple of issues which I think have been omitted. I'm wondering whether I can give that to Ms. Hurling privately.
You may just have not been with us, or perhaps you were, and I didn't explain it very clearly. I asked for these issues to come to us the way they normally come, in just an email or in handwriting to the committee secretary, so that I would also have access to it. I think I did, but I did say that that would not exhaust the process. I hope I'm quite clear on that now. All right. So members, I'm not going to delay you any further. I do need to be in touch with the respective people I have already mentioned, like yourself, Mr. Harris, purely on the technicalities of the program at this particular point. So, and I don't mean now, I mean tomorrow or the next day. So thank you to everyone here. Right, okay. Thank you to everyone here, and we can now adjourn the meeting on my watch at 12:30, but perhaps it is 22.